Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I raised the question of, okay, there are many, many religions throughout the planet. Now, of all the religions, what is the strongest one? And that's what I came up with. So I decided to put it in capital letters, the religion of white supremacy.
Earlier this month, a Quinnipiac poll found that 44% of white Americans believe Donald Trump is a racist. That's compared to 79% of black respondents and 58% of Hispanics. Meanwhile, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported that in 2017, the number of hate groups rose to 954 from 917 the prior year, up 4%. New research is helping to explain why people join hate groups and how members who want to leave can be de-radicalized. Wes and Zena wrote about these efforts in a recent piece for Mother Jones, headlined, "Inside the Radical, Uncomfortable Movement to Reform White Supremacists." In the article, he profiles Shane Johnson, a former Klan member, who joins us to explain why he joined and why he left. Wes and Shane, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Absolutely. Wes, we're approaching now the anniversary of the August 12th rally by the alt-right last year, which ended in disaster at Charlottesville, Virginia. In your view, in your research, did the election of Donald Trump encourage white supremacists to be more open about their views? Is that why membership in white supremacist and nationalist groups has grown since Trump was elected?
I'm not sure I would answer that question directly, mm-hmm. although, you know, my article profiles Shane Johnson, who's on the line, I believe, and yes. also an organization called Life After Hate, which works to de-radicalize white supremacists. It's actually the only group in America that does that. Mm. And what I would say about Trump is that Life After Hate was around, it began in 2011, and it's composed of former white supremacists who work to de-radicalize other white supremacists, sort of a support group, essentially, to do that kind of work. They were around until in January 2017, the Obama administration gave Life After Hate a $400,000 grant as part of the Department of Homeland Security's countering violent extremism efforts.
Just as Obama was leaving office.
Just as Obama was leaving office, they had awarded them a grant, so $400,000. And then in June, so which is 7 weeks before Charlottesville, the Trump administration revoked that grant.
And why was that?
There has been some reporting. They said, one official told the New York Times that it was because one of the members of Life After Hate, Christian Piccolini, was tweeting anti-Trump stuff. There are other connections that a New York Times article alleged that the Sebastian Gorka and his wife played some role in it, but we don't know exactly why, honestly. But what we do know is that this really was the catalyst for Life After Hate to become huge. So for 2012, when they were formed, 2011, 2012, until 2017, they hadn't done a lot of work, and then they got this $400,000. But then when Trump revokes the money, they blossom. They become huge because they do a good job of sort of promoting a narrative, which is a totally fair and accurate narrative, that this is insane, that we're seeing this enormous spike in the boldness of white supremacists, and now they take away our money. So Life After Hate went from receiving something like one email a week from people who were seeking help or from family members seeking mm-hmm. help for their white supremacist affiliated son or brother or something to 10. So it jumped tenfold. And since Trump has revoked $400,000 from Life After Hate, they've made up for that double in donations. So they $800,000. So they went from 30 their sort of revenues. I was looking sure. at their filings. Went from $37,000 in 2017 to $800,000, including $50,000 from the football player Colin Kaepernick.
Wow. Wow. So your story looked at this movement, this effort to reform white supremacists that like a group like Life After Hate, that's their mission. Now, Shane, are you there? I'd love to ask you a question now if I could. Wes's article begins with a violent incident that took place on July 4th, 2013, when you were still a Klan member. Can you describe that incident? Tell me what happened and how it changed you.
I can try, man. I was heavily intoxicated, and I really don't remember too much of it, to be honest with you.
Give me the summary of what you've been able to piece together since.
So, we was up for like 3-4 days, something like that. I was pretty high on Adderall and uppers, and I was drinking on top of it. And there was some words that were swapped between one of my members as he was coming over. Some guys that were African American said something to him that he didn't like. Of course, he didn't say anything back, but he comes into the house that we're at and tells us what happened. And it ended up we tied padlocks to bandanas and put them in our back pockets. And I guess the plan was to go down there and confront these guys, but there was a concert going on at the time, and it really just turned into we just kind of randomly started attacking people. I mean, it wasn't even just black people; it was white people. It was everybody.
Wow.
Everybody that was everybody that we laid eyes on, we kind of just started swinging on them.
And this attack. And, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, and then the cops came and beat the hell out of me. But
yeah, and then you were.
But yeah, one of the more embarrassing moments of my life.
I mean, this attack did not come out of nowhere. You grew up in Kokomo, Indiana, and to a well-known Klan family. Your dad apparently appeared in full robe and hood on the Jerry Springer Show in the '90s. He spent hours a day teaching you about Christian identity. What was it like to be taught from a very young age that being a Christian man meant marching toward racial Armageddon and fighting blacks and Jews in order to escape eternal damnation? What was that childhood like?
Well, for me, it was normal. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have a reference to any other kind of lifestyle. So, it was just life. That's how it was. I mean, cross lightings were common. Even like my family, what I considered my family was Klan members, you know, but it was very, there was always a sense of like paranoia. Everybody was paranoid all the time. It was paranoid that, you know, the feds were listening or, you know, or this guy was trying to join because he was an undercover agent. I mean, it was a whole lot of paranoia. And, other than that, it was tons and tons and tons of Bible study.
Mm. And yeah,
hours a day.
Bible study through a white supremacist lens, not the Bible that many of us otherwise learn.
Right. Yeah, correct. Yeah, Christian identity, man, to sum it up for people who don't know, it kind of just, they use the Bible and twist the Bible to say that the Jews are the literal descendants of Satan, and basically non-whites have no soul, you know? So, and they can never go to heaven. God doesn't recognize them. So it kind of made it easier for me, like with the, going back to the July 4th thing where we went to the concert and was attacking people. That's something I look back on now. Like I said, it's embarrassing, but it's also like, you know, people hear that and they think, how could you do something like that? You know, but when you believe that the people you're hitting don't have a soul, and you believe that you are ultimately doing something that's, you know, to better your race. Mm-hmm. It sounds so goofy, man. But I mean, at the time, it was something that I was proud to be doing, you know?
And then what happened? What was the revelation that made you realize you wanted to leave the clan and leave this sort of lifestyle?
It was a combination of a lot of things. It didn't happen overnight. Certainly didn't happen overnight, you know. But there was some things that my now wife had said to me. One of the things that stuck out was she asked me if she was not involved in the Klan, by the way. She was not involved in any kind of white power movement, which is strange. But I often dated women that were not involved in the white power movement because the ones that were honestly just weren't that attractive. So I dated outside of the movement, and sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. In this case, it worked, but she always respected my beliefs. She never brought it up. It was kind of like that's business, and you know, we don't talk about it. But one of the things she asked me one time was, we was driving down the road, and she said, "Let me get this straight. If there was a black child here, a baby, and you could kill the baby and get away with it, would you do it?" And you know, instantly my response was, "Of course." You know, obviously I would do it. You know, I'd essentially be stopping hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other African Americans being born. But even though I said it, and I said it with conviction, like I was, you know, obviously I would do that. In my head, for some reason, I had this thought that was like, man, I probably would not do that, you know. Huh. And that's one of the moments that really sticks out, because that's when I started really, really thinking about, well, if I'm not willing to do that, well, then I'm kind of lying to myself, you know. And it led to who the hell are you, you know, and do you believe these things or do you not believe these things? And you know, I was smart enough, I was old enough and smart enough to know, like, I haven't even really investigated the other side. You know, I'm hating people that I don't even know. And I don't really even know what they believe in.
Yeah.
You know, like in like progressives and left leaning people. I never even had dialogue with one. So I don't, you know, I didn't know even what they really believed. And I was going off of what I was told pretty much.
The video game industry has often been accused of being too white and too male. That can make it hard for people of color to get attention for their work. Now there's an event specifically designed to help generate excitement for new voices. Kat Chow of NPR's Code Switch team takes us there.
The Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem is this historic research library for people of African descent worldwide. So it makes sense that it's the home of the Game Devs of Color Expo, which just wrapped its third event. It's like a typical gaming convention, people mashing buttons, staring at TV screens, moving through gorgeous landscapes, but it's more diverse, with Black, Asian, Latino people. That was music from Solid State. That's a 3D visual novel, a video game about fighting the power in a surveillance state. This game, like others at the expo, is different from classics like Super Mario or war games like Call of Duty that have long lived on bestseller lists. One of the games at the expo is called Code Romantic. It teaches you the equivalent of an entry-level computer science course through a sci-fi love story. In another game called Skate and Date, you play a queer roller derby jammer, and your goal is to try to impress your crush with your skills. It's not just an expo for video games exploring themes of social justice. There are real-life card games, too.
She couldn't match her under-eye concealer because makeup companies are racist and don't have her shade.
Am Dark was in college at UCLA when she came up with the idea for this game called Objective. She got the idea because in school, she says she didn't always fit in.
There weren't that many Black people. I felt like my body type was like out of place, and so I needed a way to deal with that.
So the way she dealt with that was to create a card game that asked its players to question their assumptions about who's beautiful, smart, or thoughtful. Here's how the game works. Players hold cards with hand-drawn images of black and brown women of varying skin tones, hairstyles, and eye colors. One player acts as a judge and pulls a card with an adjective on it, cute, stylish. Each player then puts down a face card that best represents the adjective and makes their case for why. Dark says this is where the game makes you think.
So maybe I had a preconceived notion about someone, or I said, oh, this person looks a certain way, and I say that out loud, but then it gives me a moment to pause and kind of laugh at myself instead of, like, laughing at another person.
That's what happened to LaFia Watson when she was playing.
You know, like, I got a card, I think it was, like, cute or something like that, and there was one that looked cute, but they were also light-skinned, and I'm like, am I just picking them just because that's, like, the preconceived notion of what's cute in society? And I had to, like, really think about that for a minute.
That sounds kind of heavy, right? But Dark, she says, it doesn't have to be.
I like to say that it's like taking your bra off at the end of the day. You know, you don't have to put on airs, you don't have to be perfect.
Or even serious. You can have fun with important issues. For Dark, her game objective's mission is like a lot of the other games at this expo.
You know, by showing this diverse set of people and showing them in a positive light, I'm not getting people to eat their vegetables. I'm showing them that there's cake, and they didn't know where to look.
Objective is currently in development, and Dark plans to crowdfund for it in the fall. Kat Chow, NPR News, New York.
The company that owns Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas has named victims of last year's massacre as defendants in a lawsuit. MGM Resorts International is not seeking money from those victims. Instead, this lawsuit asks a court to declare that the company is not liable for the shooting. The gunman stayed at Mandalay Bay and shot hundreds of people from a window of the resort. They were attending a music festival down below. Catherine Lombardo is a lawyer representing some of the shooting victims, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
What's your reaction to the suit?
We are surprised and shocked. It's deplorable that MGM is filing lawsuits against our clients and the 22,000 innocent victims who were there at the concert on October 1st.
You say 22,000 victims. I just want to be clear. There were some 800 people injured, 58 killed. 22,000 is a much larger number of people who might have been emotionally affected by this.
That's right. They've all suffered trauma. It's emotional trauma. And let me tell you, Ari, they have suffered such deep trauma, the likes of which we had never seen before.
I understand how profound the physical and emotional pain of this shooting was, but the central question of the lawsuit seems to be, should the company that owns Mandalay Bay be held accountable? And MGM only filed this after victims, including some of your clients, sued the company. Why hold the hotel responsible for what a guest did in one of its rooms?
MGM, who owns Mandalay Bay, is absolutely responsible, absolutely liable, and negligent. MGM let the shooter come into their hotel. They had the valet guys unload his luggage. That luggage was filled with an arsenal of high-powered assault weapons and thousands of rounds of ammunition and power tools. He brought in over 20 huge, heavy bags over a 3 or 4 day period.
Are you saying the hotel should have x-rayed every guest's bags, or that his particular bags should have been searched?
Yes and yes. No and no. And let me explain why. Ever since the 9/11 attacks, the Las Vegas casino industry has been in training with the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI prior to this event on October 1st of 2017. They've all received active shooter training. In that training, they were told how to detect a potential active shooter.
You point out that Las Vegas casinos, including Mandalay Bay, were trained by the Department of Homeland Security. And in this countersuit, MGM says that's part of the reason they should not be liable. In 2002, Congress passed something called the Safety Act, which offers companies legal protection if they've used anti-terrorism services approved by Homeland Security. Why do you believe that in this case, that does not protect them from lawsuits?
The Safety Act is being misinterpreted and misapplied here. The Safety Act was created for a terrorist attack. They will not be able to prove that the Safety Act applies here. It's just not appropriate, and it's not going to hold up in court.
We asked MGM Resorts International for comment, and they sent us a statement that says, in part, from the day of this tragedy, we have focused on the recovery of those impacted by the despicable act of one evil individual. And the statement goes on, years of drawn-out litigation and hearings are not in the best interest of victims, the community, and those still healing. How do you respond to that?
It is so disingenuous. It is a publicity ploy. And it's just incomprehensible how they think this was a good idea. Let me tell you what's happening now. The victims of the shooting are coming out strong in groups, powerful. They are mad and they're coming forward like never before. And they're saying things like boycott MGM.
Catherine Lombardo is a lawyer who represents some of the victims of last year's shooting in Las Vegas, speaking to us by Skype. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
She's my friends, but I'm in France. I'm just saying.
All right, there's one thing I know. Donald Trump thinks that immigration is bad, and in fact, it's even ruining Europe. I know that because he tweets it all the time, including this one, but he's done it at least half a dozen times. He tweeted, "We don't want what is happening with immigration in Europe to happen with us." Wow, okay, that's really apparently disastrous. And he talks about how immigrants have changed the culture of Europe for the worse. So you don't want the immigrants in there, it'll change things. Now, France seems to be doing rather okay in at least some areas, one being the World Cup. They just won the World Cup. So, la bleu, vive la France, right? But I'm sure that they kept their quote-unquote culture, as the right wing keeps referring to it, both in that country and in our country and all over Europe, intact, right? They probably didn't have any immigrants at all, because the superior culture, according to these racists, is the white nationalist culture. But we'll find out about that in a second. But this has been around a long time. Remember back when France won their first World Cup in 1998, we can show you what their team looked like. It was also very multicultural. They had players who were either them or their parents were born in Africa, and some who were Arab. In fact, Zinedine Zidane, arguably the best player in the world, but if not the best, certainly in the top five, an Arab Muslim was the best player on France and critical in winning that World Cup, and that drove the right wing crazy back then. In fact, people like Jean-Marie Le Pen called the team Black, Blanc, et Beur. And what that means is black, white, and Arab. And of course, they use that phrase derisively. So sometimes people will call me brown and go, I got you, right? I don't care. Okay, you correctly deduce my skin color. So black, white, and Arab doesn't have to be derisive at all, but they use it that way, and it was an insult. Okay, they're insulted, except they won the World Cup, so apparently that combination works. But of course, the right wing didn't learn from that. And in fact, his daughter, Marie Le Pen, who's now a popular politician in the right wing in France, as late as 2010, said that she was worried about immigrants being on the French national team because they have, quote, another nationality in their hearts. Now, of course, she had no evidence of that and at all, but come on, they're not white. So they're immigrants. Of course, they have another nationality in their hearts. They can't be loyal to France. I don't hear a lot of them talking now, because now France has won its second World Cup. And with this team, the 2018 team is massively diverse and filled with immigrants. So all of a sudden, even the right wing in France is kind of quiet. I'd love for someone to ask Donald Trump about it. Do you think it's ruined France's culture to have those immigrants in and gotten worse results for the country? Seems like they got far better results. Now, to give you a sense of how many of the players are immigrants, 19 of its 23 players are immigrants or the children of immigrants. 19 out of 23. I did the math. That's 82.6%. And by the way, a great number of those are also Muslims. So what happened? I thought that multiculturalism was bad in all regards. I thought it was going to ruin the country. Turns out it doesn't ruin the country. Multiculturalism adds to the country. And why is the right wing quiet, at least for now, in France? Because, and this is what they were worried about, because sports brings people together, and it gives you a national identity, and it's tied in with your national identity. So they didn't want people in France rooting for blacks, Arabs, Muslims, and immigrants. Too bad for you. They did, and it turns out they had spectacular success. And so now all the people in France are proud of that team because it turns out, yes, multiculturalism works. I guarantee you that if you look in the comment section below, you'll see people making racist comments about how some people are good at just athletics. And then you'll say, well, hey, have they not made a contribution in culture in other ways, whether it's cuisine or arts? Well, they're good at that too. But you know, that's just dancing and music and eating and sports. And then, well, how about all the professors and all the other people in the other realms? Yeah, but those are just like small cases. But this and that. And then, do you think France would have been world champions without immigrants? Inconceivable. And it didn't make France weaker. It made France stronger. Viva la France.
Why haven't you learned anything?
This is St. Louis Public Radio. When children of color pick up a book, often they don't see themselves in the stories they read. But as St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson reports, one African-American-owned children's bookstore is tapping into an unmet need.
At sunset, the city is softly aglow.
It's story time at the I See Me African American Children's Bookstore in University City. Today's book is City Shapes. It's about a little black girl exploring her neighborhood. But that's what makes the store unique. Kids of color can see themselves in anything they read. Co-owners Jeffrey Blair and his wife Pamela say the idea for the store came when they were homeschooling their own kids.
It was really difficult to find materials that had positive black images.
And so they created their own learning materials. Jeffrey says when their kids started seeing themselves in the books they read, it made a difference.
That foundation we saw actually translated to giving them a real positive self-esteem, a clarity about a lot of even current events that are taking place, and a real excitement about learning.
The Blairs wanted other children of color to have the same experience, so they opened the I See Me bookstore in 2015. It's a place where kids can imagine themselves as a doctor, a superhero, or even a princess. Pamela says she's seen the faces of little black girls light up when they see characters with natural hair or kids who can identify with characters from the Black Panther series.
Because it makes them feel good, not just because it's a superhero, because for the first time, there's someone that is doing like magical things and I can relate to him and he looks like me.
That's something that Kiera Cross wants for her 1-year-old daughter, Skylar. As a teacher herself, Cross says I See Me is a game changer.
I remember growing up, I didn't have a store like this where I got to see myself, and I want her to see herself all the time.
The Blairs say at I See Me, these kids will see themselves at the center of their own narrative every time they crack open a book. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson, St. Louis Public Radio.
The public school. We call it the Killing Fields.
Kids of color are vastly underrepresented in children's literature. The situation is changing, but not quickly enough for some. Lisa Phillip reports on what impact this has and what some folks in North Carolina are doing about it.
Let's read from Brotherly Love.
Years ago, librarian Judy Allen Dotson was reading to her kids.
And my son said, Mommy, how come I don't see me, any children that look like me in there? And I said, you know what? I'm going to write you that story.
The Raleigh mom began work on a kid's chapter book. This August, more than a decade later, she plans to submit Micah's Magic to publishers. It's about a black boy who time travels with his friends to 1930s Chicago, where they meet the first all-black professional basketball team.
My children are avid readers, but they don't see themselves. And that works on your psyche, your spirit, your spirit.
Just a quarter of children's books published last year feature non-white characters. That's according to a report from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But only half of American kids are white.
For all children, whether that be children of color, whether that be children that may have a disability, they just want to feel normal and see themselves.
This October, Dodson is co-hosting a symposium for children's authors and illustrators of color. They'll discuss why diversity matters, not just in characters, but among creators, too. Kelly Starling Lyons is one of those creators. She's a Raleigh-based children's writer and co-host of the symposium.
So you'll see more books that have a brown face in a crowd or even, you know, a brown child on the cover. But then when you look and you see who wrote the book or is there any cultural authenticity to the story, then sometimes that's lacking.
She calls it coloring in brown.
Where it's just somebody who's brown on the surface, but there's no connection to where they come from or, you know, what they value or who they are.
Minority authors penned just 15% of children's literature published last year. That's according to the UW-Madison report. Pauletta Brown Bracey is a scholar of children's literature at NC Central University.
People of color are writing, but people of color are not getting published as much as they should be getting published.
She says minority authors hit stumbling blocks in the publishing industry, a business in which 4 out of 5 employees are white.
That poses a conflict sometimes for people of color who are working with white editors who don't have the same level of appreciation for the culture.
Bracey says change needs to come from the industry side. Lyons says it has to come from the parent side, too.
Judy and I are moms first. If we want to have those books for our kids, we can't just leave it to the publishers. Or we have to also be advocates and activists. And it doesn't have to be holding a picket sign per se. It can be little things. Your dollar speaks really loudly.
If I can find it, I will show you.
7-year-old Amia Bird is searching the children's section at a Southeast Raleigh Public Library branch. She's looking for one book in particular she likes.
When's my birthday? Because it...
Amia's mom, Kia, says she's made a point of buying kids' books that represent their family's culture and the Black experience.
Because she's going to get a lot of everything else outside of home, so we wanted her to know that there are people that look like her that have had similar experiences to her that are doing extraordinary things.
Amia certainly appreciates it.
It's important for us to have books that tell us, hey, it's okay to be who you are. You can stand out. You can be who you are. You can do what you want to do.
And maybe even become a published children's book author one day. Lisa Phillip, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Also, allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule.
In California, private adoption agencies cannot use religious grounds to stop LGBT and single people from adopting or fostering children. But the state could lose federal adoption funds if it continues that policy. That's if Congress passes an amendment to a proposed funding plan. To find out what this could mean for L.A. if LGBT people are discouraged from adopting children, we have Rich Valenza. He's founder and CEO of Raise a Child, a group based in L.A. that recruits and trains foster and adoptive parents. Rich, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, how many of the people coming to your organization wanting to adopt are in the LGBT community?
I would say for us, it's probably at about 70% of the folks that come to us are LGBTQ and looking to build families.
70%. I don't know if I expected that high of a number. What's the history when it comes to being acceptable for LGBT people in LA County to adopt?
In the state of California, the laws have been favorable for the LGBT community to foster and adopt for some time. California is one of the most inclusive and non-discriminating states that there is for all people to foster and adopt.
What did that mean then for the kids and actually the number of kids in LA's county's foster care system?
Here in LA County, we have the biggest child welfare system in the country. With over 34,000 kids in the foster system, we have more kids in our foster system than the entire state of New York. We definitely need more foster and adoptive parents in LA. I understand over the past 10 years in California, the number of foster homes have dropped by about 50%. And If you think logically about it, we don't need to be discriminating and telling good people, no matter what sexual orientation they are, that they cannot be parents. The discrimination not only hurts loving people that want to build a family or help children, but it really affects and hurts kids in the foster system.
Talking to Rich Valenza, founder and CEO of Raise a Child. That's an organization that recruits and trains foster and adoptive parents based in Los Angeles. Considering, Rich, you mentioned that California has always been more open maybe than other states when it comes to allowing for LGBT people to adopt kids. When it comes to prospective LGBT adoptive parents, is that number increasing more lately?
We feel it is. You know, ever since the Supreme Court decision in favor of marriage equality, we're finding that the folks that are showing interest and showing up at our free events are becoming a bit younger. Now people in their 30s can imagine a new kind of future for themselves, building families. So, yes, we are finding more people are looking to foster and adopt.
Now, this bill that we mentioned earlier, it wouldn't just impact LGBT couples and individuals. Who else would be affected?
So this bill actually gives the right to agencies to discriminate not only against LGBT people, but also single straight women, single straight men, unmarried couples. There's a whole list of reasons why they could turn people away.
Now, proponents of this federal law talk about things such as children needing to be raised in male-female households, and that's better for them. Rich, what does the research say about kids who are placed in homes with single parents and LGBT parents?
UCLA, through the Williams Institute and also through the Health Services School there, have done a number of studies on this, and the facts are that there's really no difference. And in fact, what we hear anecdotally from the county and from the agencies that we work with is that LGBT people go a step further to find resources and support for the children that they bring into their home. We find that LGBT people are more accepting of children with challenges, children with special needs. And I would hate to see anyone not have that opportunity to care for the children.
Rich Valenza is the founder and CEO of Raise a Child. Rich, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
The Trump effect and how it spreads. It says we are on the brink, under Trump, on the brink of fascism. New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, editorial 1210-2015. I say fascism is end-stage white supremacy. See, it's, I mean, just like in Nazi Germany. Fascism, system of racism, white supremacy, determined to survive.
Five, is it a hate crime or just a bar brawl? Witnesses say a group of white men attacked an African American at a local bar, but police still have not filed charges. Investigator Andy Sheehan reports.
It's a quiet neighborhood bar off the beaten track in Avalon, but an incident here a week ago is being investigated as a hate crime when a group of skinheads targeted an African American patron with racial slurs and then assaulted him.
It's sad that it happens anywhere, but I'm really sad that it happened in Avalon.
According to bar manager Jackie Scanlon, the assault was unprovoked. Patron Paul Morris walked into this back room when he was called a racial epithet by a group of men playing pool. They were later identified as members of Keystone United, a racist neo-Nazi group formerly known as the Keystone State Skinheads. Scanlon says when the bartender asked the group to leave, they attacked Morris.
Eight of them jumped Paul. He was hit in the face. He bent down to pick up his glasses. He was hit again.
Morris is in California, but I spoke with him on the phone. He says one member called him the N-word and saying his group would eradicate blacks one by one. Then they attacked.
They attacked me because they had hate in their hearts. I didn't do anything to these people.
If it's we're able to prove that there is a skinhead movement against an African-American male, that's a huge problem.
Avalon police detained some members of the group but did not charge. The chief says he believes they will be charged, but that the incident is still under investigation.
Right now, there's no charges filed. Right, we're working with the DA's office to file the appropriate charges because of the racial overtones.
This is a hate crime. There's no doubt about it.
Morris's lawyer, Fred Rabner, questions why no arrests have been made, saying they should be charged not only with assault, but with ethnic intimidation.
I would hope they're going to get it right. I think that they should know that we're not going to go away. So if they don't get it right, they'll deal with us.
And folks here hope that the members of this group will not only be charged, but charged with a hate crime and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. In Avalon, Andy Sheehan, KDK TV News.
Is that a real gun?
Yeah, yes, it's a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true? Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Justice for Demeek.
People came out today to protest at the Troy Police Department. Kumi Tucker joins us now with more. Kumi.
Jim and Elaine, a small but vocal group expressed their outrage about the grand jury decision that found the officer involved shooting of Demeek McDonald legally justified. Now, that decision was announced 2 days ago, and today a group of protesters say they are seeking justice as well as an effective community review board and accountability. At the protest today was Messiah Cooper, Demeek's uncle. Also there was the mother of Edson Thevenin, who was killed in a police-involved shooting in 2016. McDonald was shot by an officer in August of last year. The officer testified that he feared for his and his partner's lives when McDonald drove a car at them. They went to Ethan Rensselaer and Troy acting on a tip about McDonald's whereabouts and the car he was in. McDonald had been wanted by parole for months after officials say he cut off his ankle monitor. The officer fired 4 shots, 2 hit McDonald, who survived. This protest was much smaller than the ones in the streets and at City Hall shortly after the shooting. Today, police had cordoned off the street. Officers were stationed all around the protest area. At one point on this hot day, officers walked among the group, offering and handing out water bottles. Cooper says the mayor and police are complicit in what he calls the attempted murder of his nephew, and that this protest is about more than Demeek.
It's justice for every person of color that's been robbed of their life by, I say, America, and sent to what I call our concentration camps. It's the prisons that stretch across America that's filled with my people.
Now, Troy police said in a statement that while many think of the police as guardians of life and property, they also have to protect people's constitutional rights, which they did today by helping protesters rally in a safe environment.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
I'm here to march for justice. Hell, I marched with Martin Luther King August the 28th, 1966. I was 10 years old. I'm here to try to keep my great nephews and grandkids alive. Because right now, the way it's going right here in South Shore, they're dying in leaps and bounds.
It's been 3 days since the police shooting of Harith Augustus, a barber on Chicago's South Side. And there have been protests and clashes with police every night since. Harith Augustus is the third person killed by police in Chicago so far this year. On Sunday, Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson released a 40-second video clip of the shooting and urged protesters to trust the investigation.
I know everybody is emotionally heightened. I get that. But at the same time, we have a process in place. And if we have to hold individuals accountable, we will. Don't judge things on your emotion. Let the facts guide your decision on what you think.
Despite the superintendent's press conference, hundreds of Chicago residents turned out on Monday to protest on the block where Augustus was killed. Here's Roberta Wood, who's lived in Chicago's South Shore neighborhood for 40 years, speaking with WBEZ at the protest.
Well, I think that the police have to be accountable. I think that they have to be trained
not to shoot first and ask questions later. They have to be trained not to accost people because they're black or brown. You know, I hold this, the leadership of the city is responsible. It's their department. They got to do something about it.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today in the city of Chicago, where Patrick Smith has been following the shooting and its aftermath. He covers criminal justice for member station WBEZ Chicago. Patrick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about some of the facts of the case for some of our listeners who may not be familiar. What do we know so far about Haritha Gustus, and what can you tell us about the moments that led up to his death?
Well, we know that he was a 37-year-old barber who lived in the South Shore neighborhood just a few blocks from where he was killed. He was, you know, by reports, well-liked in the community, well-known. You know, as a barber, he cut a lot of people's hair who lived in South Shore. And he was out on a main thoroughfare on Saturday evening when police stopped him. The reason they gave for stopping him was language I've actually never heard them use before. They said that he demonstrated the characteristics of having a weapon. So they stopped him for that. And in the video that you mentioned, you can see he's talking to one officer and actually has pulled out his wallet, seems to be showing his ID to the officer, when another pair of officers come up on him and one grabs him by the wrist. He sort of yanks himself free and turns. And in that video that was released, you can see that he has a gun on his right hip. And as he turns to run away, he grabs at his hip. And at some point during all that motion, one of the officers starts firing. This was body cam footage that was released. It is silent, so it's impossible to tell when the first shot is fired. But he was killed in that incident.
Now, the preliminary results of the autopsy were released on Sunday. What do we know so far?
Well, we know that he was killed by multiple gunshot wounds, and you know, the medical examiner has ruled it a homicide, although that's obviously not a judgment call. It's just a simple fact. What we will know when the full autopsy is out is how many bullets hit him and where they hit him, which is one of many things that the community is still trying to find out about the shooting.
And we saw overnight on Saturday that some protesters reportedly threw rocks and bottles of urine at police, and in some cases, police fought back. I want to play a clip from an activist who was on the scene that day.
Unarmed black women. I watched women beg Chicago police officers not to hit them. And I watched Chicago police officers hit them with batons. Chicago Police Department is not fixed, and that has to be noted.
Are you seeing more of that mood, Patrick, as the days go on?
Well, I think what you have heard is a focus on the way the police acted in the protest after that. You know, there's been some focus on this shooting. There's been some talk just about sort of broader police reform issues and some focus on how police interacted with protesters. You had this situation where, you know, it's a busy Saturday evening in Chicago. Police shoot somebody and it draws a crowd in. And so you get a lot of residents who might not otherwise have gone to a police protest who are involved. And then a bunch of, you know, the sort of usual faces you see at police protests. One thing that might have, you know, sort of made this more of a clash than you see at other protests is the fact that, you know, they were centered around an active crime scene and crime scene that the police needed to preserve, which is why you didn't have the option of the police sort of letting the protesters go wherever they wanted to. That I'm not saying that justifies whatever the police may or may not have done in that instance, but that created a different dynamic than you get at other protests where there was a very specific area that police were sort of centered at and they didn't really have the option of leaving or trying to appease the crowd.
We know, of course, that the Laquan McDonald killing 4 years ago. After that, the U.S. Department of Justice released a pretty intense report criticizing the Chicago police for the force that was used on black and Latino residents of the city. Is the release of the body cam footage in this case and potentially other moves that the police department might make, the call for calm, are those in reaction to changes in the Chicago PD as a result of the Laquan McDonald case?
Well, not really. The release of this video did not follow the protocol that was set up as part of those reform efforts. They released just this one 40-second clip of silent body camera footage that shows the gun to try to sort of keep the peace, but it didn't follow the typical pattern that we get here. You know, usually it's about 2 months before they release any video or audio. And one thing that protesters and lots of people have been saying is how can you release just this one out of context clip and not release anything else? We're still waiting on all the rest of the information.
Patrick Smith covers criminal justice for WBEZ in Chicago. Patrick, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
We want it to be done swiftly. We don't want politics to play a part in this. We just want justice for my son, Eric.
That's Gwen Carr, whose son, Eric Garner, was killed by police in Staten Island after being put into a chokehold for selling untaxed cigarettes. On Monday afternoon, 4 years after Garner was killed, the New York Police Department announced it would move forward with internal disciplinary proceedings against two of the officers involved in Garner's death. It's a step towards accountability for the family and for the Black Lives Matter movement, which emerged at the center of the fight for justice for Garner. Erica Garner, Eric's daughter, largely led that fight from within Black Lives Matter until she died suddenly last December.
I want to be a cop.
The Asheville Police Department may have hit another bump on their road to gain trust in the Black community. A new investigation documents the department's efforts to gather intelligence on civil rights groups in the aftermath of a fatal police shooting and ensuing racial tension. Experts say this kind of monitoring is not unheard of, but may undermine public trust. This revelation comes months after a video leaked of an Asheville police officer punching and choking a Black man accused of jaywalking. The officer was arrested and later indicted. Joel Burgess broke both of these stories. He is the city government reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times. Thanks so much for being here, Joel.
Good to be here.
So tell me, Asheville police have admitted to monitoring civil rights groups. Who were they monitoring, and what do we know about why?
Through a series of questions and some back-and-forth emails with the Asheville Police Department, they acknowledged that they had launched an intelligence-gathering operation into Black Lives Matter and another group called Showing Up for Racial Justice.
And do we know why they were being monitored? Were there particular threats made to cause this investigation?
That's right. So this dates back to July 2nd, 2016. There was an officer who shot a Black man named Jerry Williams. The shooting was eventually ruled justified by the district attorney, but it set off a very tense summer with a series of protests that peaked, you could say, with a unpermitted downtown march where police said that protesters banged on cars and blocked roadways. Demonstrators eventually hung a banner on the side of the police department that said Black Lives Matter and actually went inside, and there was a sit-in, an overnight sit-in, and eight people were arrested. Sometime after that shooting, during a lot of these protests and demonstrations, police say that there were threats made against officers. Again, this is a piece of information that we got out of them through a series of questions. That's really all we know about the threats. Police have declined to offer any other information. We've asked in a lot of different ways, but that having that bit of information, learning of the threats, is what caused the police chief, Tammy Hooper, to launch this intelligence gathering operation, according to what we've learned.
So I know there's an important clarification to be made here between intelligence gathering and criminal investigation. There's a distinction there. Can you clarify that and how it fits into what's happening in Asheville?
Yeah, I can to some degree clarify it. A criminal investigation. Let's start with the intelligence gathering. Essentially, according to the APD, the Asheville Police Department's own policies, they can start this type of intelligence gathering. They can start some kind of monitoring if they have a reasonable suspicion that a group may be engaging in some kind of criminal activity or planning some kind of criminal activity. You could use information from intelligence gathering then to actually launch a full-fledged criminal investigation. A criminal investigation, of course, would have to have a higher degree of certainty that crime was actually taking place, because a criminal investigation, by its nature, is to either prevent a crime or to solve a crime. So it's confusing, but I think people can sort of see how those play into each other. There also are probably some very bright lines and maybe some sort of fuzzy lines that could be crossed in terms of what can be done in one but not the other.
So there are sort of clear rules about sort of what kind of information can be kept and tracked, how long it's able to be sort of in the hands of the police department. Tell me a little bit about what we know about the use of these kinds of intelligence gathering practices. I know you spoke with a variety of experts. Is this something that is common?
That's really interesting. I spoke with some former New York City police officers, high-ranking officers, actually, and one who had worked undercover. And he said that, yeah, they're probably more common than most people would think. And what we're talking about is maybe not the kind of deep undercover operation that might get glamorized in some police television show, but intelligence gathering, though, where officers officially have opened some kind of action, some kind of operation into groups, and they will monitor them in different ways. They'll look at social media. In the case of Asheville Police, they told us that they, along with monitoring social media, they went to what they call open meetings or open events. We asked police if, in attending those events, officers wore uniforms. Did they make it obvious that they were police? And they declined to answer. We asked if this was done in an open fashion and not an undercover fashion, why wouldn't the police just simply tell us? And they declined to answer. And it's hard not to read between those lines and believe that this may have been done in an undercover fashion. And you ask about legal experts and other experts, and yes, they say that it probably happens more often than we know. It gets sticky and touchy, though, when you involve groups whose stated goal is peaceful social change, particularly in terms of civil rights groups. And some of that is because of the history that the government has of monitoring, infiltrating, and I think you could arguably use the word spying on civil rights groups in the 60s and 70s.
So, right, this is obviously, some activists are saying, you know, this harkens back to a time when civil rights groups were watched closely by the FBI and the police. What are activists in Asheville saying about being monitored? What have you heard?
I think they were surprised. They were surprised to hear that the monitoring happened in the way in which we believe it happened. They said that both representatives for Showing Up for Racial Justice and Black Lives Matter said that they knew of no threats that had been issued by anyone in the groups. They said they have no intent or desire to harm police. They also said, and it's worth noting, that they never saw uniformed police or anyone who identified themselves as police officers at their meetings. And this, again, is leading us to look toward the potential for an undercover investigation into these groups.
So I know you haven't had the opportunity to have a sit-down conversation with the chief about this, but do we know if a criminal investigation has been launched or how the data that has been collected is being used at this point?
So very good questions. And again, yes, we actually requested an interview with Police Chief Tammy Hooper, and she said that they would only answer, city officials would only answer via written emails. And a lot of those emails came from the spokeswoman for the department, Christina Hollingsey. And Hollingsey, in declining to answer a lot of our questions, including the very good ones that you just asked about what happened with this investigation, did it end, where's the information, cited state public records law that tells us that a lot of things are public records, but some things that are exempted are records of criminal investigations and records of intelligence gathering. Criminal intelligence gathering is actually, I think, the phrase that is used in the statute. Now, talking to the North Carolina Press Association, they say, the attorneys for the North Carolina Press Association say that non-disclosure isn't mandatory. In other words, police don't have to give this information, but they can if they want to. And they've declined to so far. They've declined to tell us to confirm that the intelligence gathering has actually ended. In talking about it, they said that it happened in July and August. It sounds like they mean that it ended in August, but it's hard to know exactly. We don't know if it turned into a full-fledged criminal investigation.
So let's talk a little bit about Chief Tammy Hooper with the time that we have left. I know she recently fired the second police captain in a few months. Can you tell us a little bit about what is going on internally in the department and the chief's role?
It gives a sense that there's some turmoil, at least in the upper ranks. There was, as you said, just in the past few days, she's fired a captain named Mark Byrd, who was there about 20 years. Prior to that, in May, she fired a captain who was in charge of criminal investigations, arguably the most important division in any police department, and his name was Stoney Gauntz. In both cases, there was accusations that they had not been truthful about certain things. One very interesting tie to both firings was ways in which she said these captains either interfered or were not truthful about a police beating that happened, and you referenced it in our opening segment, toward the end of August. And this, as many people may have heard, it was an officer named Christopher Hickman who, along with another officer, stopped a black unarmed pedestrian named Johnny Rush. The stop escalated, and the pedestrian ended up being beaten, shocked, and choked, according to police body cam video, which we had. And she has linked both of these captains to the way in which either the investigation was done or sort of statements made in the wake of it. And I think she is saying with Byrd that he has been attempting to undermine her as the chief in statements that he's made about her handling of the case.
Well, thanks so much for your reporting. We will continue to follow your work. Joel Burgess is a city government reporter for the Asheville Citizen Times. Thanks so much for the update.
So good to be here.
Talking about how Mandela, how they love Mandela.
Former President Barack Obama is delivering a speech as we speak in South Africa to mark the centennial of the birth of Nelson Mandela. It is one of Obama's most high-profile appearances since leaving the White House 18 months ago. He warned that what he called the politics of fear are on the move.
With each day's news cycles bringing more head spinning and disturbing headlines, I thought maybe it would be useful to step back for a moment and try to get some perspective.
Let's get some perspective on this speech from NPR's Scott Horsley, who has been listening in. Hi there, Scott.
Good to be with you, David.
So the speech today was not supposed to be overtly political, and Obama has said that Nelson Mandela was really the inspiration for his own political career, right? So it has to be quite a moment for him to be giving this speech. What was his overall message?
Well, it was, in general, a hopeful speech. Hope is obviously a part of the Obama brand. He talked about developments over the last century, the spread of opportunity and prosperity. And he talked about how that was sort of symbolized in that moment almost three decades ago when Mandela was released from prison just a couple of months after the Berlin Wall came down.
You remember that feeling? It seemed as if the forces of progress were on the march, that they were inexorable.
Wow. So this really was a celebration of Mandela's legacy on the eve of what would have been his 100th birthday. But it sounds, though, like Obama also wanted to use this to sort of give a cautionary message, right?
Absolutely. He said those progressive forces were not inexorable and that even as prosperity and democracy spread, inequality and insecurity came with it. And as a result, he said, around the turn of the century, there were a lot of people who missed what would turn out to be a powerful political backlash.
In fact, it is in part because of the failures of governments and powerful elites to squarely address the shortcomings and contradictions of this international order, that we now see much of the world threatening to return to an older, a more dangerous, a more brutal way of doing business.
and that older way of doing business, he said, is characterized by strongman politics, by authoritarianism, by tribalism and xenophobia. The former president did not mention the current president, Donald Trump, by name, but clearly Trump is emblematic of the movement that Obama was describing here.
Interesting, deciding not to bring up the name of his successor directly, but talking more thematically. But I guess there's no hiding what he was sort of addressing there.
That's right. And this is not the first time Obama has done this. He has generally kept a low profile since he left office, but there have been some exceptions. For example, just a little over a year ago, Obama engaged in a conversation near the Brandenburg Gate in Germany with Chancellor Merkel, where he hit on many of these same themes. This has been a longstanding concern for Obama. We heard it in his own exit speech. We heard it in his final address to the United Nations. His story is that the progressives have a story to tell, but they can't take their progress for granted, and they need to make that case. And we expect we'll be hearing more from Obama making that case this fall as we get closer to the midterm elections.
The midterm elections that are very important to his party. All right, NPR, Scott Horsley. Scott, we appreciate it.
Good to be with you, David.
Damn you, Obama. 100 years ago today, the man who went on to become the first leader of a democratic South Africa was born in a small village in the Eastern Cape. The centenary of Nelson Mandela's birth is being marked by a series of events involving world leaders this week in South Africa, including a keynote speech from the former US President Barack Obama. The BBC spoke to Graca Machel, Nelson Mandela's widow, and a founding member of the Elders, the human rights organization set up by her former husband. She talked about today's celebrations and the impact he's had on millions of people worldwide.
Nelson Mandela is not an individual. Nelson Mandela is much bigger than that. It's simply the values, the principles which he represents, which millions of people feel identified with. So the celebration for me are sort of mixed feelings. To feel so happy, yes, physically he has departed, but he remains in those millions. But for me personally, is the more I see him in these TV programs, it is something which is a reminder that he is no longer here. And of course, it's painful.
Graca Machel. But some South Africans are angry about enduring inequality and feel that Mandela made too many compromises in his negotiations with the apartheid-era government. Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
It's the 100th anniversary of his legacy, and we want to go bigger and better than last year.
It's that time of year again in South Africa, and on the face of it, Nelson Mandela has lost none of his power to inspire.
This year, we want to double it.
There's the usual frenzy of Mandela-themed charity drives and foreign dignitaries invited to join in.
Thank you so much.
This is Barack Obama getting a huge welcome yesterday here in Johannesburg, where he spoke of the enduring power of Mandela's legacy.
I believe in Nelson Mandela's vision. I believe in a vision of equality and justice and freedom and multiracial democracy.
But, and it's an awkward but, 5 years after Mandela's death, some here in South Africa are starting to question the great man's achievements. Believe in yourself. On a cold morning, the rapper Cheesy Beezy is filming a music video on, naturally, Nelson Mandela Bridge. But the generation that never knew President Mandela is wondering whether South Africa's enduring inequalities are partly his fault.
He should have done, like, free our people more and not sell us out. Large numbers of black people, they should be owning companies.
Okay, his legacy is great, but he failed South Africa by not pushing harder for us to be at least free from the oppression from the white people. You understand? When it comes to the businesses, the land.
Some of this frustration is simply the product of a lost decade of economic stagnation, corruption, and soaring youth unemployment. But there's more to it. Public hearings to discuss land reform and specifically proposals to confiscate white-owned land.
We don't depend on them, on white minority. We're sick and tired.
Let's move swiftly to take our land back.
We'll regain our dignity. Land is ours. These people do not own the land. Why do I have to explain myself after so much suffering that they have caused us?
EFF, thank you.
This anger is being exploited by populist politicians, but that doesn't make it any less genuine. Most people here recognise that Nelson Mandela and his team made necessary compromises in the early 1990s, ending racial apartheid peacefully, but allowing whites to keep their economic power.
There were compromises, and in some instances those compromises were quite bad, and it's only showing now.
The veteran journalist Matata Sedu says it's inevitable that those deals are now being questioned and new solutions sought.
Just the mere fact that questions are being asked is actually a very, very good thing, because it means that young people are engaged with their own present and future.
Which, presumably, would have pleased Mandela himself, a man who preached reconciliation but fought above all for justice.
We must therefore act together as a united people for national reconciliation, for nation building, for the birth of a new world. Let there be justice for all.
The voice of Nelson Mandela, ending that report by Andrew Harding.
The Cows, context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 21st, 2018. So I have been told. Anytime I hear Nelson Mandela's name mentioned, particularly if it sounds like, you know, somebody has the audacity, the gall to sound like they're talking bad about Madiba and what he did or didn't do or what he should have done, I always feel almost obligated to go back to medical apartheid on my top five. The legend Harriet A. Washington, medical apartheid. We read it on the book club back in 2016, the final chapter of medical apartheid, where she talks about the global effort to terrorize black people in the medical field. And she talks about the united white effort in South Africa to control efforts, counter apartheid, counter white supremacy efforts, of which Madiba was a huge part of. Tip of the spear, I think they said. Mkontwe Sizwe. But she talks about the chemical and biological warfare programs against black people in South Africa and Madiba specifically. If you give me one moment, I am going to go ahead and pull it up so that I can read that. Give me 1 second and I'll read that paragraph. Mandatory anytime I hear Madiba's name mentioned. This here, compensatory call-in, dial-in. If you have thoughts you would like to share on any of the sound clips that we heard, anything else that happened over the past 7 days, if you have suggestions, thoughts, questions, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things to get to before we get to the listeners. I will try to be efficient. First and foremost, the iTunes feed is up to date. No thanks to Racist Man, Racist Woman, because it's still not working correctly. Like, I will attempt to upload a file and it won't work, and I have to go back and do it 3 or 4 times and then it'll finally work. But after doing that repeatedly for each of the different segments, the iTunes feed is current. Every broadcast, including the book club from yesterday, Ralph Ellison, our 12th session, is in the iTunes feed. Program should be there. If you have any difficulties, let me know. I can now focus slowly on getting the older content that is not working, getting those archives fixed as well. But all of the current content should be available at iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox. Lots of options for accessing the cows. Let me know if you have problems or issues. Next, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest. If you think the program is constructive, you can visit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Huge thanks to all of the listeners who have kept the context of white supremacy on for a decade in the face of extraordinary obstacles, interference to our iTunes feed. We've had our literally had the program thrown off the air while we were broadcasting live. Extraordinary obstacles in the time that we have attempted to broadcast. Much obliged for all of the listeners, victims who have supported and allowed us to continue this effort. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also support by nabbing items from the wish list. I know the Amazon binge day was earlier this week, but you can feel free if you do any continued Amazon shopping to nab an item for Gus T. My wish list is also linked on my blog. It is listed at Amazon under Gus T. Renegade. I will post it on the social media sites as the broadcast continues. Again, huge amount of gratitude to all the listeners who have invested and nabbed items for Gus T. over the decade that we've been broadcasting. I hope the content has been helpful, giving out accurate information about white supremacy racism, what it means to be classified as white. Got my mandatory quote, the great Harriet A. Washington, in my top five, along with Invisible Man, Medical Apartheid. Chapter 14, second to last chapter in the book, she's talking about the globally coordinated effort upon whites to control blacks everywhere, but particularly in South Africa in this instance. And I want to pause for a second. When you don't understand racism, there's a reason Mr. Fuller in his books, producejustice.com, there's a reason Mr. Fuller has very first thing in the book. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else that you do understand will only confuse you. There's a reason that he says that so frequently, has it at the front of his books. When you hear someone talking, when I hear someone talking, man, that no good Madiba Kun sellout, Uncle Tom, I can't believe he made those deals, made all these concessions with whites, helped them out, all this nonsense. Really? You really think in a global system of racism, white supremacy, you think Madiba could have walked into that meeting 27 years in greater confinement? You think he could have walked into that meeting? Look here, Cracker. This is what it's going to be, PW, both and the rest of you all. This is what it's going to be. Get the pen out. Get the demands down. That's the way he was supposed to go into the meeting. Let me get to my paragraph. Medical apartheid, the great Harriet Washington. She said, no black South African leader was safe from Bassan. This is one of the white terrorists in their global operations to get this chemical biological warfare program. According to testimony from former chemical biological weapons program scientist at Bassan's trial, Nelson Mandela was still in prison when Bassan's cadre of scientists plotted to poison him slowly with heavy metal thallium to render him mentally incapable of managing the nation's anti-apartheid resistance. Chillingly, the well-connected Bassan once cooked dinner for an unsuspecting Mandela at a mutual acquaintance's dinner party. And she has the footnote for that sentence, the great Harriet A. Washington. That's what I mean about understanding global system of racism, white supremacy, and that is further evidence of why that book is in my top five all time. It is in the archives book club. But having an understanding of, I mean, really what we talk about, why Dr. Kanban says, racist, you should think scientists, not almost used the metaphor, not the foolishness, the tomfoolery that was at the very beginning of the broadcast, dangerous, but tomfoolery at the same time. You have the suspected racist talking about how he was in this brutish white terrorist organization. He's reformed, all cleaned up now. Went out. That's what they did for Independence Day. We're going to go out and beat up some niggers. No good reason. Just looking for someone to beat up on. Find some dark people with no soul to beat up on. Racial focal pointing. Our caller in Florida coined the term, thankfully. So we have a label for it. But in that segment, to make it seem like the only people that we can identify as white supremacists, this guy, and he's not even a racist anymore. All it took was watching a little bit of the Young Turks, no less, and exchanging a few messages online with a quote unquote progressive, having a few conversations with some dark people, and I'm all good. Now, the thing you did not hear, that interview went on for about 20 minutes. As it continued, they talked about the science, so-called scientific evidence behind this, and they said what they call residuals. That was the term that they used, that individuals like this white reformed racist, as they say, that he'll have residuals. So he might have an impulse like, oh, nigger, might happen, you know, might have an intrusive racist thought. Residuals, that's what they call them. Like, are you serious? Woo! And they were deadly serious. Deadly serious. And that's why you end up with, in my view, that's why you end up with a lot of victims of white supremacy who are very confused about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. We have a very difficult time conceptualizing racists. Deliberate racists are much encompass much more than what is being presented. Just some quote unquote skinhead who's now reformed and doing well, thanks to the good folks, Sank and the Young Turks. Continuing. Man, oh man. I could have done almost a whole program. I had to take notes. I forgot how much I had to talk about yoga. I'm going to have to put myself on the clock. So many things happened. Okay. We had class, yoga teacher training yesterday. Almost at the halfway point for teacher training. Got about another month to go. We have to do the adjustments section. What this means is if you take a yoga class and you do these postures, one of the reasons that you go to a yoga studio as opposed to just doing these postures at home, which you could easily do, is you can get hands-on adjustments, or at minimum, you have an instructor there who can help you with alignment for some of the poses to make sure that you're doing them correctly. Sometimes they can, even if you are already doing the pose correctly, they can help you deepen the stretch or give you some additional add-ons so that you can, you know, do more in your workout. So they show you for all of these postures, all of the different adjustments that you can do to help someone stretch deeper or whatever, you know, the posture is. I could do a lot of talking about adjustments, going to a yoga class and adjustments as a black person. I think people had asked about the black female that I'm doing training with to have her on as well. I think the both of us could probably easily fill up 2 hours talking about being a black person in a yoga class and adjustments. So in this period, this section took up all 3 hours of the class going over these adjustments. I wish I had, this is maybe one time where if this was a video program, this would be better because then I could show you the images of what some of these adjustments look like so you could see, you know, just talk about chilling. Man, I'm looking at these. Let me see if I can use my words to describe some of these poses. So if you can imagine you're prone on the ground, on your belly, and you're about to do like a back stretch. So you're going to lean like your chest up while your belly and, you know, legs are on the ground. One of the adjustments is the instructor. That would be me in this case. So the person comes and they're like straddling you. They're standing over you where their feet would be about where your ribs are. So they're kind of at your torso and they would be leaning down where their knees are pretty close to your shoulder and kind of giving you a very gentle pull back as you lift up to kind of help you deepen the stretch. Not all of the adjustments are this intimate. Some of them you can just, you know, kind of gently pull a person's arm or shoulder or that sort of thing where it's not very invasive. But I mean, some of these, like, whoa, you're literally, you would have another person seated almost on your lap. Literally. That's why I said, I wish I had, you know, the images so that you could see what I'm talking about. Like, yes, that's the adjustment. I looked at these and I was less interested in even participating in class because I was like, oh man, I am not interested in giving these adjustments to any of the whites in this class. And I mean, truth be told, I am not a very touchy person. Even if it was a whole lot of non-white people, I wouldn't exactly be excited. Like the cute black female in my gorgeous, woo, I would not exactly be excited. Even if it's her, like I said, she's still a stranger. I am not a super touchy person. Curmudgeon every day. So I'm not excited for that reason. And then I'm seeing all these adjustments like, oh, I have never received half, like 75% of these adjustments. I've never received like ever in a yoga class. I'm thinking about that. I don't want to touch these white people. I don't want them touching me. Just, oof. I'm less interested in doing this. They tell us to partner up. We're supposed to take turns. I do want to learn this because, you know, I would like to teach a yoga class with black people at some point, and I would try to get over that to at least, you know, be able to conduct the class correctly and do the adjustments because that is important, and they can help you deepen your practice. I do want to learn the adjustments, but I don't really want to touch, you know, suspected race soldiers, and I don't want them touching me. The very first adjustment is one of those where you would kind of be almost straddling the person kind of at their rear. I just said immediately, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I'm not performing the adjustment, and I am not having that adjustment performed on me. Next, we went to the next posture and did some of the less invasive ones. I was still disgruntled about that. There were several that I just said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. Like, have some black self-respect. They tried to get me. Yeah, the whole touching thing. Woo, I could talk about that for a whole 2 hours. And it even came up flagrantly because I just kept looking at these postures like, I am never going to give this adjustment in any class. There's no way that I'm going to do this. We keep going. The guy who I am still trying to find out his racial classification, he looks at me and he says, they're talking about one of these adjustments where you would be straddling the person. The instructor would be straddling the person. And he says, like you, Gus, you know, you're still, even with my miraculous weight loss and my spiffy yoga physique now, I am still right at about 200 pounds, over 6 feet tall. So I'm still like towering over the vast majority of everybody that's in any yoga class that I take. So he says, like you, you know, you probably would not want to do this adjustment. That could be intimidating. That's the word he used. And I agreed. I felt like, let's make it plain. That might be intimidating for some of the folks in class to have you, you know, standing over them in that position, to have someone that large and that sort of thing. And I was thinking the exact same thing, although I made it explicitly racial, particularly if it's a lot of white women. Absolutely not. And that right there goes to why I would never. I was cracking up laughing like that wacky Ivy. Do you ever think I could retire and this would be my full time job where I'm going to be straddling whites and giving them massages? That's going to be my full time job, to hand in my microphone. Are you out of your cotton picking mind? Yes, I know that was a metaphor, just using that for emphasis. But yeah, I cracked up laughing thinking about that repeatedly last night for the full 3 hours of the adjustments, and then I came home and took a shower. Next, the black female. I said I could have talked about yoga for the whole time. Black female. So we walked home from, or not walked home, we walked in the direction of our respective residences, put it that way, after one of the classes. We're talking. And one of the listeners, they had talked recently, listener had asked about this, like, you know, what about relationships and black people, you know, trying to at least even counter racist, you know, trying to black males, black females, trying to get along. Why not? Now, we're just trying to walk down the sidewalk. No, nothing amorous, as they say, just walking down the sidewalk, constructive dialogue. She got bumped, I think, about 2 to 3 times she got bumped by a white person, and she kept calling it out directly. Like, Do you see the hostility of these whites? And we're walking on Broadway in Seattle. I hate that street. I absolutely hate. I try to avoid that street. I feel like I'm not safe, that anything hostile could happen walking on that street. And that's unfortunately the street where the yoga studio is. But she got bumped repeatedly. And she said, I have in the summertime here in Seattle, I have established a pattern. I pick my lane on the sidewalk. That's where I'm walking, and I'm not moving. If there's going to be conflict or contact, I welcome it. I'm braced. I'm prepared for it, but I am not moving. Now, what could Gus T say to that? As she got bumped, I think as she was even saying that, bam, she got bumped again. And she said, I encourage you to try it. Now, as I'm looking down at her to have this conversation, again, Gus T, over 6 feet tall, right at about 200 now. She is, I'm guessing, I'm going to say maybe 5'3", 110 pounds. That would be my guess. We'll say 115. 115, maybe 5'3". I was thinking, you going down the street with that attitude, I'm not going to move. Whatever contact happens, if it's conflict, fine. At your size as a black female, and me doing that at 6 feet and 200 as a black male, I'm not sure that I would make it home, make it back to my residence. The police are out on Broadway regularly. I thought that immediately. I am not sure that I would make it to back to my residence. I don't think I'd be able to conduct that experiment very long. Listeners, are feel free to share. If we have any listeners who conduct that experiment where you do not move and just see what happens as you have contact with whites on the sidewalk, let me know. Whew. I got one more yoga story. Bear with me. So today I do four yoga classes today. Still got all my work done. My third yoga class, white male instructor, suspected racist. They do what they call, they're called personal shares. That's what they are, where you're supposed to relate like the theme of the day's yoga practice to some aspect of your personal life. So it can be a story about something you learned, or if you took a trip, or anything, whatever you can think of. So white man, he's given his personal story, and he said it changed. That was going to be the theme, change, to be mindful about how you change and transition in life, you know, in your yoga practice, all of that. So he says his friend that he just, you know, they went to school with, they grew up with, all this, he got a call. His friend died. Drug overdose. Uh-oh. I think red in Nevada immediately. Uh-oh. Drug overdose. He doesn't mention so-called opioids, but drug overdose. He keeps going. He says, yeah, that's my guy from back in the day. And, you know, we did lots of drugs and, you know, hanging out. We did way more than exploring, and the whole room giggles. And he keeps going, yeah, we did all these drugs and, you know, my life changed and doing, you know, what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, he's continued to do his thing, and now he's dead. And, you know, it just really hit me really hard. And, you know, this is how he said, this has happened a bunch of times, where lots of friends of ours have been lost to drugs. I thought, wow, that stood out to me. Now, I don't say I know tons and tons and tons of folks, and I don't say I've kept up with everyone, but I don't know tons of my black friends who have died from drugs. Now, you all can report on that as well. Maybe Gus T is just a prude and I don't, a misanthrope. Maybe I don't have enough friends, but I don't know very many of the black folks, family, friends, people I went to school with. I don't have racks and racks of them that, you know, overdosed on whatever. That is not what I've seen with black people. But anyway, no one seemed off-put about this. They thought it was grand. Lots of hugs, kisses, grand sharing white man with a history of drug use. Next, the segment where they were talking about the LGBT adoption rights in California. I thought it was extremely significant that that organization was, the name of the organization was Raise a Child. They did not give the spelling. You could spell Raise a Child, R-A-I-S-E, Raise a Child. You could spell that R-A-Z-E, Raise a Child. I've seen where whites do things like that regularly, where sometimes the spelling betrays what the actual intent of the motivations are, if that makes sense. I thought from that same segment as well, I thought it was so important when they asked about information, data on LGBT parents having these offspring. And he pivoted. He started with the research. He went to UCLA. This was Rich Valenza was the person speaker's name. He started with UCLA's research, and then he pivoted to, well, anecdotally, LGBT parents, they go out and work harder. It started with factual data, which there didn't seem to be anything to support, and then it just pivoted to anecdote. If we want to take anecdotes, let's take the LGBT parents that just went off the cliff and killed all those non-white children that they had. If we want to just pick anecdotes, that'll be the anecdote that I take. Next, I'll make my last one, and then we'll get the callers. No metaphors for the Saturday program when they were talking about Asheville's COINTELPRO Operation 2018 to nab black identity extremists. They said the Asheville Police Department might have hit a bump in the road with regards to quote unquote race relations and how they're dealing with their Negro problem in North Carolina. Shout to Mr. Scotty Reed. Bump in the road? What is that? Is that talking about replacing white supremacy with justice? A bump in the road? What are you even talking about? That's what I mean about being precise. I think we listened the vast majority of these reports. You had whites, a terrorist group of whites attacked a black male in a bar here in the States. They talked about Madiba in South Africa. All of these different reports of things happening, police killing black people all over the world. Most of these reports didn't even mention the term racism. We got bump in the road and all these other metaphors and kooky terms. Precision with language is extremely important. Racists, they are masterful. Part of their master deception is using analogies, metaphors, similes, all of these comparisons, often to make it seem like two separate entities are identical. Frequently, that's not the case at all. They are brilliant at doing this, at creating confusion with words. Victims of white supremacy, including Gus T, we've been exposed to this behavior. And many of us, including myself, we're still learning. As such, we've not come to conclusions on some topics. Sometimes we don't have logic, so we'll substitute and use a metaphor in the hopes that that will convey what we're thinking. Often it does not. It only produces more confusion. If you could please, please make an effort to be mindful, not use metaphors. Just speak explicitly, directly to what it is you would like to say. That would be most appreciated. I will prompt about that. If you could take about 5 minutes to share whatever commentary, questions, analysis that you have, that would be grand. Make sure everyone gets at least one opportunity to speak. Once everyone has spoken at least once, if you have additional thoughts or questions, we will get you on the line for your additional thoughts. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Oh, if you know you are in a noisy environment, please use your mute button. Helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast, just helps so that people don't have to fight over a lot of background noise. If you could refrain from using speakerphone, that would be appreciated as well, because that adds frequently a lot of echoing. Much obliged. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening, Gus.
Thomas in New York.
Greetings. Greetings to everyone. Interesting clips you played this week. In my opinion, Trump did not increase the membership of hate groups. The Obama presidency did. If we recall, gun sales went to all-time highs under Obama, especially his first term. And under Trump, they're at all-time lows. The KKK member that decided to quit the Klan because, well, first he framed it like his white wife or white girlfriend was not a racist, but she's with him. And she asked him if he could kill a little black boy and get away with it, and he said he could, but then he had this deep heart felt moment of reflection and empathy, where he went back on that, and it, I guess, changed his mind and made him leave that organization. I just want to say that white deception equals black confusion. The last thing I wanted to say about that clip was Jesus never existed. Christianity is a synonym for racism, white supremacy. And I think that clip pretty much played that out. I'll be in Vegas next week. I'll be nowhere near any country music concerts. The MGM victims who were shot, but not they were not shot or physically injured, but they faced trauma unlike any in world history. You know, that just tells you how white people think. And, you know, I'm going to put this statement on the record. Under the system of white supremacy, the only people that can be victims are white people. LGBT families, seems to me like they're interested in adopting children that can't say no or stop or don't. I'm totally against them allowing LGBT families or any race to adopt children. It's not a normal type of environment for children to grow up in. And for them to pick children with mental illnesses or things of that nature, it just seems like they're taking children that won't have won't be able to defend themselves. The France World Cup. Now, the white lie or the white theory that sports bring different races together and creates patriotism, I don't agree with that. When it's a team sport, it's harder to hide, like soccer. But individual sports like boxing proves that theory to be wrong. I mentioned this before on the show. McGregor and Mayweather's fight a year after Trump's Make America Great campaign. All that patriotism. 2 weeks to the day after Charlottesville. All that nationalism. Whites at the MGM Grand for an American fighter all had on leprechauns. Irish flags, none of them had on an American flag. None of them represented America that evening. They represented white, and the white fighter was an Irishman. I don't advocate violence, but Chicago has way too many gang shootings and so-called black-on-black murders to just march around and throw piss projectiles at police. I would like to see them take out some of that anger on the right people. Last thing, I think you kind of just touched on it, monitoring black activist groups. First thing is, that's nothing new. COINTELPRO, I think that came out then, but you know, that's all part of the BIE report. And I said this on the show a year ago, maybe longer, that in the future they'll make us urban terrorists, and I think they just choose the term black identity extremist instead. But in that report, gave police the ability the ability to go and look into these organizations because they're deeming them as people that want to attack police. So when the police said, oh, we got threats, automatically let me know. That's all they have to say. To be covered, to send undercover officers to infiltrate a black organization if that organization threatened them. I mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Good to hear from you, sir. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard? Go ahead.
Much obliged, sir.
Thank you for allowing me to share. This is Red in Nevada. First, I wanted to say to Thomas in New York, just real quick, if you're coming out here, just keep in mind it's been in the hundreds. For the past several weeks, just because the sun goes down does not mean that it's not going to be out of the hundreds. I know right now it's still 100 and it's a 7:42. And it's usually about 100 degrees from noon to 7 p.m. or beyond, 7 p.m. and beyond. And we've been having, and not to discourage anyone or anything like that, and there's been lots of thunderstorms and raining. I know lots of people around, or not lots of people, but I've heard some people at my plantation have spoken about how their power has gone out. I don't know how long their power went out for. I know my power went out for only about a couple of hours. It really didn't affect me too much. But there's just some of the interesting things that have been happening recently. To the clips, I thought the first clip, I definitely appreciate that because I feel like it's when I started learning about racism, white supremacy, and even before that, I started to kind of look up hate groups because I wanted to try to learn more about the people who basically in my mind hated me for no reason. And there's also another hate group, a Christian hate group. It's called the Phidias Priest. And I thought that was really interesting how they took one Bible verse. I think they're one of the ones who take one of the Bible verses about how people of different backgrounds should be separated, which is not a bad thing. But then they kind of, use that to be more terroristic. I thought that I also agree with Thompson, New York. It's like just because that white woman who was later to become his wife was not already in a group, because he called it respected his beliefs. So it's kind of like I think that they were trying to make it seem as if she was a good person just because she asked the question, would he kill a black child? People kill black children all the time, whether in our food and what have you. So it's not like, putting a gun to a black child's head is one thing, but I'm sure that, she wouldn't be, even in Flint, wherever, they wouldn't feel so surprised or feel any type of way about killing a black child. The body image thing, I definitely could understand with the whole gaming segment, because I know for the short time that I went to a white school, it definitely affected me negatively about my body image, just being around all those white people. The MGM thing, how they said the lawyer for the victim, and just that whole 20,000, that's utterly ridiculous. And I think it is, they do a lot of that whole chauvinistic thing when it comes to that whole, because they call it October 1st. They don't ever say shooting. They don't ever say, of course, even in that clip where they said he was not a terrorist, then show me what a terrorist is, because it seemed like he was a terrorist. To me, you shoot people. And the whole thing about them and with that whole argument about, they let him bring all those guns there. I was, I know I take a lot of pictures of different things that I think are racist, and I feel like it's definitely helping me. So when I speak to younger black children, we take pictures of, ourselves and families and stuff like that, but we also maybe can have some type of videography of or picturography or whatever of, the racist things that are happening. So that way maybe they can have that visual proof. But there's like a gun show, I know, like almost every month, sometimes bi-monthly. So there's no way. And some of these take place at casinos, which of course have rooms and stuff like that. So that they're not going to get anything for that. I sometimes with the whole walking on the sidewalk thing. Sometimes I feel like I'm not going to move. But then when I, just reading Invisible Man, and, sometimes I feel like, maybe it might be better to be invisible. So I can't be both. I cannot, not want to move out the way and then also, want to be invisible. And sometimes, people, they really will run you over. And they're, that's happened to me before almost where, they'll just basically take up all the sidewalk with their strollers and all whatever else they have. So I'll leave it there. Thank you for, one last thing. Trump had recently, or his administration had recently put something on whitehouse.gov about now they're kind of basically blaming the opioid epidemic, or kind of making it seem as if the opioid epidemic is because of Mexico, because they said Mexico's poppy cultivation has increased over the years. And it's that if anyone wants to look it up, it's called New annual data released by the White House Drug Policy Office shows record high poppy cultivation and potential heroin production in Mexico. So just blaming their problem on non-white people. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that, Red in Nevada. She didn't, but I will. I will emphatically discourage non-white people from hanging out too long in Las Vegas. It is horrible. It's hot. I've been to Vegas. I didn't even go in the summertime, and I still hated it. And it gets cold at night, like really cold. If you go like in the wintertime, they have the extreme heat that Red just told us about right now. And then it gets really cold if you go in the summertime at night. It's absolutely horrible. Yeah, worst place in the world. Deep fried Twinkies. That's what they brag about in Las Vegas. Deep fried Twinkies. Welsing moment. Caller who yielded to Red, thank you. Do you have commentary, sir?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, this is Henry from Chicago. In regards to the interview with the former KKK members, I remember the interviewer was asking one of the former KKK members a question in regards to his experience, and he talked about how he was high and drunk, and he couldn't remember anything at a particular moment that the interviewer was talking about. And it's so interesting how racists, you know, love to claim something else in regards to, well, you know, I was high, I was drunk, and not, you know, and not really getting to the deep reason why they are racist because they are white. And why, you know, and so basically, you know, his excuse was he was high and drunk and intoxicated for being, you know, for being a racist. So I thought it was real interesting. In regards to the MGM grand lawsuit against the victims of the shooting in Las Vegas, they asked the lawyer about the question of why these victims were suing, or they were asking the lawyer of the defendants of the victims of the shooting, and she gave out some number about the 22,000 victims of the shooting, and then the interviewer had to clarify the numbers of that's not the number, but it was the 22,000 people who were affected and the families. I love how racists kind of you know, give these misleading statistics. You know, I think somebody earlier had said, you know, whites like to be the victims, and they like to play the victim role in this particular case. So, and then it also takes the blame off of the real shooter. You know, Stephen Paddock, white supremacist. You know, and his rage, his like rage, and you know, killing, you know, just killing everybody. So I thought that was pretty interesting. The Chicago, in regards to the Chicago police murder of a non-white black male, they released a video, and the video was basically 30 seconds, I believe, and very inconclusive, but all I saw was white female officer who basically just grabbed him, and basically all hell broke loose. Because if you saw the video, the non-white black male, and there was a black officer that was sitting there talking, and I believe he was about to give him his ID, and then the white female officer just ran up and just grabbed him, and then that's when everything you know, everything kind of went crazy. But what was interesting was the comments on social media by honestly, you know, non-white black people, victims of white supremacy and VGQ, about how he deserved it and the anti-black rhetoric that was going on, because, you know, he shouldn't have ran, or he shouldn't have did this, and he should just comply. Well, you know, in the system of white supremacy, you know, there have been many, you know, black victims who have complied and still have been murdered and executed by the police. So I was very surprised of the anti-black behavior by non-white people. But like I said, VGQ, and they are also victims of white supremacy. That's it. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged. That segment on Chicago, they started that segment and they had audio from the protest, and it sounded like there were some people playing drums and they were chanting killer cops, gotta go, that sort of thing. they victims guarantee qualified. They can, you know, say what they want to say. I thought that was, if I'm being truthful, the word that came to mind, I thought that was really embarrassing. If enforcement officers, I just said, you know, if I was on Broadway here and I chose that experiment to, I'm going to walk down the sidewalk, any whites that I bump into, hey, that's just what it is. I'm not moving. If I'm gunned down by enforcement officers for attempting that experiment, I would say it's really embarrassing that they were out playing drums about, you know, killer cops who gunned down Gus T. Like, that is an embarrassing response, in my opinion. I am a victim. I have VGQ as well. And that's my thought on it. I did not see the video, and I was almost thinking of not playing that because you know, the same way that I knew The Hate U Give, wretched book that we read, I knew how that was going to end. I know how this is going to end. The Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, insert name, Ayanna Stanley Jones. We know how this is going to end. This is what the system of white supremacy produces. I think this is a part of the terrorism campaign to just have blacks inundated with these images, victims of white supremacy inundated with these images. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. I just have two stories. I'm pretty sure some of you are aware of the incident that took place in Clearwater, Florida, I believe. And if you haven't, it is on... it is on, I guess, YouTube or something like that. It's supposed to be surrounding the quote-unquote stand your ground law. From my understanding, a white person shot to death a black male. Primarily what took place was a black female who was the mother of the children between herself and this black male. She parked in a handicap spot without the handicap credentials. White male, not enforcement official, not officially anyway, came out the store. Came out the store and basically you can see on tape where there was some sort of exchange between himself, meaning the white male, and the driver, which reportedly was the black female. The black male, who apparently was with the black female who was still in the car, he came walking down, I guess, assuming out of the store to where the dispute was going on, and without stopping, with both hands, just shoved the white male to the ground. Without even getting up off the ground, the white male produced a firearm and shot him one time in the center mass torso area. According to the report, it was a mortal wound. He walked back where he came from, and according to the news report, he collapsed in front of his children. Did you report that, Gus?
No, sir. First I've heard of it.
Yeah. White male. Apparently, from what I heard from another source, that this white male frequent the store area, harassing non-white black people. And as we know, that all white people intermittently can become enforcement officials, whether they are officially with a badge or not. And that was a classic example of such terroristic behavior. I have had the unfortunate experience of my vehicle being involved into, now the number is up to 3 accidents. One, I take it because that is my offspring doing driving. But the other 2 times was getting hit in the back. And it's by white people whose primary language is Spanish. One, as we were, we meaning myself and my offspring, leaving the campus of Florida International University. That was about maybe, it was earlier this year, maybe about 2 months ago, 2 or 3 months ago. And the other incident took place about maybe 5 hours ago, en route to my mother's home to help take care of her, coming to a stop light, and bam, hit the back of the car. The reason why I mentioned because it was in this case it was a white female. It was a white female, and another reason why I mentioned because I observed her almost immediately taking the position of the victim. I mean, almost immediately, without me even calling her. I'm still sitting in the car. She gets out. She gets out of her vehicle, approaches my vehicle, with the idea in mind, you know, almost trying to demand me to roll my window down, like she's the police, like she's law enforcement, and to ask me, "Am I okay?" and whatever. And basically, I said, "I'm on the phone right now," because what I was doing, I was on the phone calling the calling law enforcement, you know, to the area, and to the call anyway. And in turn, she attempted about 2 or 3 times, because I kept separating the distance. I didn't want any contact with her at all. There was no premise for her to have any contact with me physically or verbally. And I made it my business to maintain that. Law enforcement did show up. It was a non-white black male. Happened to be a non-white black male that grew up in the same area that I grew up in. Basically, based on my tactics on my code on what to do when something like that happens, or when you're encountering a white person, period, I managed to be, I would say, talking to everybody on this phone. So that's basically all I have to say for this evening, and I will continue to listen to what everybody else has to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. First and foremost, glad that you and your offspring were safe after the accident. I think somebody does say regularly, in addition to being sober, buckle up each and every time you are in that vehicle, driver or passenger. I hear that pretty regularly, I think, around here on the cows. I hope everybody was buckled up, but I'm super glad that you and your offspring were safe and that you had your code together to deal with her attempting to be the victim and then harassing you and demanding that you, you know, talk to her right now, whatever she wanted you to do in the situation. Excellent job calling the enforcement officials, reporting it, being codified, and how you navigated through that whole stressful situation. I hope you are able to hit her insurance company hard to get all of the damages, fees, stress, everything else covered in triple. With the first report that you gave, I think Mr. Fuller said, if you get shot, you have been arrested. I think it's also said, matter of fact, I think when I say, let's wear our seatbelt, I think the way it's said, it is driver or passenger, let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. I don't know anything about that situation other than what I just heard. So I will have to do more digging. I am reminded of, again, Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com, where he does have his own very detailed counter violence code. I know that I have talked about to him repeatedly about counter violence, and he's been on this program and we talked about it. And one thing that he said, those type of situations where a white person, suspected racist, is abusing a black person out in public. And this is something that happens spontaneously. This is not planned. You don't know any of these people. You're at, you know, a convenience store or a restaurant or whatever, and something like this happens. In these type of situations, if anything, you want to run. That was his suggestion. And in fact, it was presented with this exact type of scenario, a white male terrorizing a black female, and someone, a black male, intervene or no. It was presented in the exact same way. And, you know, people gave their thoughts about what to do, what not to do. And he said, you never know what could happen in those sort of situations. You don't know if that individual has five other individuals with them who are armed or who got bats and clubs or whatever the case is. You don't know if that individual white person is armed. You don't know if that's an undercover enforcement official. I think we heard about that in the clip as well. It's so many things that you have to consider in a system of white supremacy. His recommendation, if anything, was grab that black female and help her to leave the scene immediately. If you can get any identifying information, great. But if it even seems like it could be something where a white person could be heading towards violence, this is not something that you planned. This is not your, oh yeah, I set this up 5 months ago. This is exactly what I thought was going to be happening today, Saturday the 21st, and he just made a huge mistake because I've been planning for this for months. If that's not what it is, if anything, you grab her and see if you can get out of there quickly. If anything else, maybe you witness since you can help. But I mean, and I think he even said, if you want to do that, if you want to intervene, no problem. Just make sure that you are prepared to kill, be killed, or both. I think that was the way that he said it specifically. And if you have not thought it out in advance that far, I'm willing to die today for this right now in the next 30 seconds. Maybe you should take the advice of getting out of there or go grab that black female. We are going to get out of here right now. And then we can call the enforcement officials or, you know, whatever you want to do. Let's just get you to safety and then we'll see if we can handle the situation. Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have commentary, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, if I've been talking nonsense, definitely let us know. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. This caller from 712 here. I just had a couple of things I wanted to say tonight. And I hope everybody is doing the best that they can in the situation that we are in, horrible situation of racism, white supremacy, terrorism, but we can overcome it. I want to speak on the race terrorist. At the beginning, he made sure to tell us that the white woman that he was involved with was not a racist at all. She wasn't in any type of racist movements or group, and I didn't believe him. And second thing about the black people, the black writers that are having trouble getting published, that was interesting. I like to write. I would like to get published one day. That made me think about Dr. Wilson. I wonder, I'm sure she had a lot of trouble getting her book published. LGBT people. I wrote down that LGBT people gave up their right to procreate, so why would they go around adopting children? This has to be a terrorist move focused on non-white black children or non-white children, period. It just, logic says that it is a terrorist move. I also put that this adopting of these non-white children, this does support the system of racism, white supremacy. And also I put a note, whenever we're playing around with sex, the joke is on the children. And I got that from Dr. Wilson as well. And then the last one, that the 8 men that attacked one black male, that's a common terrorist move of white people. Usually they know, whether it be a man or a woman, a white man or a white woman, they know that they can't go up against us one-on-one. It's a small chance that they would win against us, and so they have to go get a lot of extra people to help them, because it's been my experience in Sioux City when using the word nigger, we would be out barbecuing, just out in the yard or whatever, and it seemed like white people would always yell nigger, but they would be in the car driving by, so we had no way of get into them. So they use that as well. And then one last thing, I just wanted to talk about a report on my other most important job that I do, and that's attempting to raise counter-racist children. I went up to my child's school, and there was like a long line of cars waiting to pull into the main area where you do go and pick your child up at. And so we were just waiting there, but after a while, it just seemed like somebody should have been moving in the line. And so there was a white man in front of me, and he must have felt it too, because he got out, and you can tell he was like pulling up his pants, and oh, I'm so frustrated, I got to get out of my car and walk up here and see who's holding up the traffic. And so he walked up there. He walked about 5 cars up. And I don't know who he talked to, but when he came back, he just was so mad. And he walks back to his car, and he's mumbling under his breath, and she won't move her car. I can't believe this. She won't even move her car. And so he got back in the car and just, just sat there and was going to wait. And I didn't know what was going on. And so I was like, I don't know, and maybe this wasn't safe, but I did, got out of my car, and I wanted to walk up to see, what's going on with the traffic. So I get up there, and there is a teenage white female. She's just on her phone, and I'm like, well, you have to move because you have like 7 or 8 cars behind you. And then she says, I'm just here picking up my brother, and he's coming out right now, and he'll be out right now. And I just, I told her again, I understand that he's coming out or whatever, that's fine, but you have cars backed up, and you need to move now. And I said, you need to move right now. I said that, and she put it in drive, and she pulled off. And the power that these white females have, don't underestimate it, because it's just amazing that an older white man comes stomping back to his car and saying that, this teenage female, she just refuses to move, and he didn't do anything to get her to move. I was, I went up there, and I'm a black person. I mean, she moved. I don't know why he couldn't get her to move, but it was just a good example of how the power of white females, they're horrible. And then I wanted to ask firefighter, the woman that hit you from the back, hit your car, in behind. And she said, you said that she played the victim. I just wanted to know, did she start crying? And I'll mute my line.
She had water in her eyes, and she attempted to look stressed out. And that's the first thought came to my mind is this look and behavior of distress. And I mean, it's just a situation where she more than likely, I can't really, didn't really look inside of her vehicle, but more than likely she was tampering with some electronical equipment preceding her running into the back of me. She was charged with the accident, of course, but I was near stopping point because it was a red light and the cars ahead of me were already stopped and I was in the process of stopping. And most cases like that, it's because the person's not paying attention, and they're not paying attention these days. Why? Because you're playing with some sort of equipment.
Hashtag weeping white women. Been encouraging that one for years, talking about that. Talk about the yoga class. Anyway, other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, guys, callers, listeners. Thanks for taking my call. I would first like to comment on the audio clip discussing the non-white black couple that own the children's bookstore. I just want to commend them. That just shows a great amount of black self-respect, and that's something that we need more of in our communities so that our children can see more positive images of themselves. I also want to say that I agree with the mother that mentioned that we can't wait on these large publishing houses to publish books for our children to see these positive images of themselves. Another caller mentioned that she likes to write. I just want to say there are several self-publishing platforms out there that you can take advantage of that are very easy to use, very affordable, and all you have to do is go online. So that's something that we should all look into if we want to allow our children to become writers, or if we're going to write books for ourselves. Also, to comment on the hate crime that was committed against the non-white black male, I think he was at the bar. I was paying very close attention because, you know, we have to pay attention to these words with these white supremacists use. And the department representative, I'm not sure who he was, if he was the chief or whoever, but he said, we haven't proven that it was a hate crime yet. And I thought, how interesting is that? Let that white supremacist had been any other race as they want to classify us, he would have been labeled a terrorist immediately. So I felt that was just another way of them skirting around calling him a terrorist. Should be plain and simple. Last thing, I was recently reading an article that was done on a study that white supremacists are using this new term for children whom they allow to classify as their own gender. So they're allowing these children to classify whether they're boys or girls, no matter what their born sex was. And they call them babies until they've decided what it is that they want to be. And I thought that was so interesting because how can a child make that decision for themselves, one? And two, for you to create a whole nother category as they've been doing, I mean, we're all familiar with that, but to create a whole new category and to call them babies, I mean, that's just creating further confusion, which is only going to cause more problems in the future. Another thing that I thought that was interesting about this report is that it indicated that the majority of these parents and other adults that support this new term are, of course, LGBTQ, and another term that I recently learned about through reading this article was throuples. And I never heard of that, so I went and did some research on it, and it's basically three-party couples, whether it's two males and a female, two females and a male, which, again, creates further confusion. But the last thing I have to finish my comment with is for all of us to think about, these are the people that are adopting these children that they can't relate to culturally, personally, or even as complete and correct mother and father roles in the traditional sense to create that sense of normalcy that we need in society. And we can already see these effects playing out in this generation, in the younger generation. But I mean, if this continues to happen, man, I don't have any words. That concludes my comment. Thanks for taking my call, guest.
Yes, ma'am. Much obliged. For the publishing industry, Al Jazeera, they did a report within the last couple years where they were talking about racism, white supremacy, and certainly, of course, you have tons of non-white authors who have a difficult time getting published. But in this Al Jazeera segment, they said specifically the publishing industry that is dominated by white women. When I say dominated, they put a number on it, and it was approaching something like 75% of the executives in the publishing industry who make a decision about which books are going to be published are white women. So this is a problem explicitly, specifically rather, if we're talking about publishing and racism, white supremacy with regards to which books get out, now we are in the domain of racist woman. Other folks that we've not heard from at all. If you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace, Gus, and peace to all of the listeners and all of the callers tonight. This is V from Central New York. I'm very happy to be with you tonight. I looked up and realized that time was, wow, it was elapsing pretty quickly, so I better call in because, as I was last week, I am working and doing research tonight. First and foremost, very important, please, everybody, support this podcast with a financial contribution. I will be doing so in the next 24 hours. This is very, very important work. Not only for us, but for our children and for our community. Gus did not pay me to say that. I am meaning this. And then last week, I mentioned pedophilia, and I felt a little uneasy making somewhat of a connection between pedophilia and homosexuality, and I still feel a bit uneasy about that. But the Irritated Genie, he actually posted a TED Talk on his YouTube channel on pedophilia, which should be watched by every Black parent, every Black person, really, but definitely every Black parent. It speaks for itself. I cannot speak for it. It was disgusting, but definitely go and pursue that. On the clips, the NPR segment on publishing, particularly Black authors having a problem getting published, I find so much of what NPR does disingenuous because many of the topics, especially when it relates to business that they speak on, those conditions outside of being a direct result from racism, white supremacy, is a direct result from a economic war that was waged successfully against Black businesses starting, I mean, it's always been going on, but when integration became the top priority for whites in the elite, they automatically went after Black businesses to close them down so they wouldn't be direct competitors for many of the businesses that they owned. And the war on Black media has been absolutely relentless. The FBI in the 1960s and the 1970s particularly released memos. You can go online, you can find them, you can read them, where they said one of the biggest threats within the Black Power movement was Black bookstores, Black publishers, Black magazine producers, Black journals. They were adamant that they had to stop that. And so 50 years hence, We are now seeing the result of that. And thank you, Gus, for making that point about white women being a driving force, which is a metaphor, I think, being very instrumental in the publishing company, the publishing business. It is not something that we talk about a lot, but yes, Huffington Post is a really good example of this. And the type of stories that are published over there. Secondly, anger in the Black community. A lot of the confusion that is happening in South Africa, along with over here in the United States, is because of anger in the Black community. And we have not figured out successful ways of channeling that energy, that anger, into constructive means. That is something that I think we as counter-racists, we need to really work hard at developing over the next 2 or 3 years. That'll stop a lot of the confusion and help to turn it into more constructive ways of dealing with racism. On Eric Gardner, please, if you haven't seen the video in a long time, go back and watch the video. Stop it before he actually is chokeholded. But the narrative that Eric Gardner was selling loose cigarettes is a lie. He even said it in the video that he did not have cigarettes on him, that they did not have any proof that he was selling cigarettes. And the only reason that he was out there at that moment when they killed him was because he was stopping a fight. Actually, I don't believe he said that. I believe the man who was filming it, who is still locked up, if I'm not mistaken. But he said that Eric Gardner had actually stopped a fight. So that, I think, is interesting that we keep citing this false story that he was selling loose cigarettes. He said he was not. I'm inclined to believe him. And then finally, my racist, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, but an event that happened surrounding racists in my building, I've had issues with this person before, but I can never prove it was them. I was washing my clothes last week, and I was washing my shoes. I took my clothes out of the washer, put them into the dryer, of course. When you do that and you start up a dryer, it's going to cause some noise. Well, I went back up to my apartment, came back down to throw out some garbage and realized, wow, the dryer sounds a little bit less noisy. Didn't think anything of it. Went back up, continued making dinner, washing dishes, went back down, grabbed my stuff, grabbed my clothes out of the dryer when they were done. The next day, went to get my shoes out of the laundry basket, and one of them was gone. I knew almost immediately that somebody had taken it, and I saw the person who I assumed took it. I didn't say anything to them, but I gave them a very stern look and would not speak to them. 2 days later, my dirty shoe, as if it had been in the trash, appeared in the laundry room on top of the dryer as if it had been there the whole time. Gus, thank you so much for the work that you are doing. Thank you to everybody who contributes. Again, please support the show. Have a great night. Peace.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. I'm sorry you had your property trashed in that manner. That is system of white supremacy. That's what I mean in terms of that sort of mentality, taking a yoga class or any sort of environment where you have to be in the presence of whites and dealing with that sort of thing. And then to come back and smile and laugh like everything is fine. Everything is jolly. Having a pleasant old day on the plantation. Other folks that we've not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Mr. Steele, yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I'm reporting live from somewhere in northern lower Michigan. I'm visiting my family after having spent maybe 2 years not seeing any of them. So So it's been a very welcome homecoming. I'm pleased to report that in my home, which is a Catholic household, there is no depictions of white Jesus that are currently posted, which is a welcome change that I'm noticing after not having been here for 2 years. In fact, the only depictions of Jesus that are in my parents' home now are depictions of a black Jesus. So that's something that I think it has to be some sort of influence that I've had. My parents have been keeping track of my Facebook posts, so I think that they're slowly coming to a point of less confusion, and I think that's very welcoming. Now, regarding Eric Garner, it's very interesting. I had a conversation with a police officer from New York, I believe the state of New York. I don't know exactly what municipality that he's in charge of patrolling or doing whatever his duties are. But he goes by the name of Bob the Cop on this program that I was speaking on. And in the discussion that we had, he not only did he falsely cite Eric Garner for selling loose cigarettes, but he also made mention that he and most officers do not regard the Constitution when carrying out their duties. I brought it up to him that, you know, there were several things that appeared to have violated his constitutional right to life, and he just kind of scoffed at this, and I believe the phrase he used was constitution, smonstitution. And then he quickly diverted to a line of reasoning that you hear very often when race soldiers are defending their actions that violate the rights of citizens. He mentioned that he wanted to come home safely and he wanted to just do his job. And then he proceeded to attempt to blame all of Pentaleo's actions on the black officer who was granted immunity from federal prosecution in this case. And he said that he views it as he was just doing what that black lady was telling him to do. And, you know, I just want us to be very mindful that the people that we're dealing with that often are wearing these badges and performing the actions of an officer, they are not, in their minds, many of them are not regarding the Constitution that they swore an oath to, and they're not in any way encouraged to go ahead and act within the confines of the law. They view themselves as law. They view themselves as the arbiter of right and wrong, and it seems that they've been empowered with the ultimate decision-making power of who lives and who dies. So keep that in mind when you are encountering these people. And along those same lines, anytime you see a race soldier, be they in a badge or not in a badge, and they're hurling racial slurs, I think at this point it's safe to regard that sort of behavior as a threat on your life. Because in Florida, there was recently a case where a race soldier was apparently accosting several patrons at a local business, and he walked up to a car that contained a black woman, and he started to verbally assault this person, and then her boyfriend approached him and then gave him a hard shove in order to defend this victim of racism. He gave this race soldier a hard shove, and immediately the race soldier reached for his pocket, pulled out a gun, and shot him square in the chest. And the local sheriff's department is refusing to prosecute this as a crime, saying that this was covered under Stand Your Ground. So I just say that to victims who are empowered enough to defend their own lives from race soldiers. If you are defending your life, please do so until the person who is attacking you is completely immobilized, cannot produce any weapons to go ahead and shoot you later, and is in a state where you are the person who is the one making the report about what occurred. Because I guarantee that the person who was shot in his chest, I guarantee that he would rather be alive, and I guarantee that if he knew that this race soldier were armed, he would have defended himself even harder and even in a more complete fashion. So don't let these people still stand after that they've attacked you. And also, anytime that they are running around and using racial slurs in public, assume they're armed and assume that you have to defend yourself. So I'll go ahead and mute my line at this point in time. Be well. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Steele. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ivy.
I can't hear anything.
We can hear you.
May I be heard?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
I can now. Can you still hear me?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay, great. That kind of threw me off a little bit too. Okay, I'm back to my notes. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Just like you, Gus, I don't know many black people who have overdosed. Thank you, Red, for your commentary on the opioid epidemics with them blaming Spanish-speaking non-white people. I just thought that was incredible information. I didn't know that. As far as so-called black people on social media saying that I believe it was an officer or whoever the black person was who was murdered by a race soldier, saying that they deserved it and they should have complied, I will caution anybody to when they see people on social media sounding like white people, assume that they're black people or that they're non-white people, because they could be white people impersonating us. They do that a lot. So a lot of times when I was listening to the comments that these black people supposedly said, it just sounded like white people to me. And usually that's very unusual. Usually I hear, black people saying, all this stuff about, compliance, that doesn't mean that, you should murder people and things of that nature. So if they're talking like white people, they probably are white people. Not that some non-white people aren't so confused that they, don't have, racist talking points. I mean, and by that, I mean talking points that they get from races, but that's just very unusual. And I just would, really assume that they're probably white. I had a question for everyone on the line, including Gus, which is, and I don't say this to disparage non-white people who are not black. I'm just asking this question because I'm just, wondering, which is, how realistic is it? Do people on the line, including Gus, think it is that we're going to solve the problem of white supremacy with other non-white people versus it just being black people? Or how realistic is it that, just black people are able to solve this problem ourselves? So I'm trying to think if I need to clarify any more. I just know that, there's definitely a lot of anti-blackness everywhere, with black people, with other non-white people, all of that. And it's been talked about on this program that, the white people, they can kill all the black people, but I don't know if they can, I doubt very seriously they can kill 90% of the globe. However, given all the anti-blackness, where are you going to have, you know, most of your chance just dealing with, you know, the people who are the most victimized, which are black people, or, you know, trying to recruit everyone? And so just to sum up, I guess my question is, what's more realistic, and can black people, if need be, solve this problem on our own? And I think that was all I had. Oh, the last thing I wanted to say is to the firefighter, I'm sorry about your accidents, and I wish you the best with that. And I'm sorry about that player also who passed away. And I just hope that everyone ends up, you know, being as well as they possibly can through that difficult time as well. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Indeed. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Mhandisi. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I also had a question as to whether the phrasing fight white supremacy, is that a metaphor? Is that an idiom? Or that's how you say it? Is that, like, does that actually make sense? Can you really fight a system? Can you fight any other system, you know? So is it you're fighting white supremacy, or should we be more specific and say that we're fighting white people, but are we really fighting them? Or maybe we should be more specific that we're ending white supremacy and replacing it with justice. But even what does that mean? I'm trying to figure out, well, the first question is whether fight white supremacy, whether that is a metaphor or an idiom. And then the other is, I don't really know how to say we need to end the system with my words. And then the last thing I wanted to say is I'm over here on the West Coast now. I'm traveling, and I don't know if it's possible to stop there in Seattle and say hi, or maybe do a yoga class or something. I don't know if you're open to that. I don't think that I'll be here by that time in August that you were saying, I think the 13th or something.
Wow. Like now it's, oh man, we're not even halfway through training. Like I can't, we could take a class, but it would not be Gus teaching the class. That is, need a bit more training for that. But, you know, I'm always down to do a yoga class. So, you know, you'd have to let me know what, you know, if you're hanging out here, what time it is, that sort of thing. But to come take the yoga class, absolutely. And for the exactly what I just said, doing those adjustments yesterday, that is exactly why I said I would much rather balance this out and not just be here to teach this class to a lot of whites. So, Mhandisi, I think you did say you might not be in this area by a month from now or so when I do have to teach a class. But if you make it back out here, anybody else, you can come take the class. It's free. You can wear your counter-racist T-shirt, and that would be much obliged. To your first question, it sounded peculiar to me, the phrasing fight white supremacy. I generally do not say fight white supremacy. I'll say replace white supremacy or counter racism. I generally do not say fight white supremacy. It just sounded peculiar. Even beyond that not being something that I don't think I say, I am not accustomed to hearing other people say fight white supremacy. That being said, your question was, is that a metaphor? It certainly, it would depend. I would have to hear the person explain, like if somebody was using that phrasing, I would have to hear them like explain what they meant. Like if they conceptualize white supremacy as being whites, individuals classified as whites, then yeah, I guess you could say that literally that's what we need to do, or however they explain what they mean when they say fight as well. You know, I could see where that could be explained where it's not a metaphor. I could also see it being explained where it could be a metaphor. It would just depend on, you know, the person saying that, what do they mean by fight? What do they mean by white supremacy? But that, it just sounds peculiar to me. It sounds like a phrase I do not think that I use. Might have used it once or twice in life, but it's certainly not what I regularly say. And also a phrase I'm not accustomed to hearing other people say. What was the other question?
Well, fight white supremacy. I've heard fight racism, and maybe I just, put white supremacy as a placeholder, but I've heard that. But the other question, I'm not sure. I think the other question was whether it would be okay if I went down to Seattle, since I'm over here on the West Coast, to take a class.
Oh, I just said, yeah, I'm down to
take awesome.
Teaching would have to wait. You'd have to be patient for the teaching. But taking, sure, just let me know, and I'm always down to take a class. Teaching, everyone be patient, and that day is coming.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
For sure. Anybody else that we missed? I think it's August 19th. I have to look at the calendar, and I have to double check because I don't have a time. They have to, it's quite a ways away, relatively speaking. We have a lot of information to cover between now and then. I have to see if I can get through all of these despicable adjustments between now and then. But I think it's August 19th. I'll give the exact date and time for the class for folks who, if you want to come and help. That's, in my view, that is an act of counter racism right there. If you want to call that fighting racism, I will agree. Just to keep me that way, I don't have to do all this touching with whites in the class. You can wear your counter racist t-shirt. I would be much obliged. August 19th, you can come take the yoga class for free that I would be teaching. Did we miss anybody? Folks have a hand up that we've not heard from at all.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir. Our caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with, I think I heard the Super Mario theme, and that segment where I think they were having some kind of event or a convention, and I believe one of the commentators mentioned that it was a game that they were testing, where I guess you get to play as someone who was, I don't know, like, did you hear that? I think it was, you get to play as someone who's a homosexual or anti-sexual.
Oh, yes, I did. The acute listeners, I inserted the sound effects from Do the Right Thing, the scene, the what they call the gentrification scene. You can put that in quotes. Where the group says, I put that sound effect in for that reason specifically, that is the game that we get that's supposed to be about social justice and fighting racism, where you get to role play a queer person and impress your presumably queer partner.
Yeah, because I had caught on to that as well. I had noticed that, especially where I think they were having the popular Comic-Con event around this point in time of the year. And I know for this event, I guess it's supposed to be for mostly non-white people. So that's interesting that they are trying to push content like that in a video game. And images are very important when it comes to that, and comics, literature, graphic novels, very important. And as far as there was a local event that occurred, there's a black female who was sitting in a school board meeting, like they have like the elections coming up. So it was a debate on the who's going to be running for school board. Okay, and it was a non-white female, and she had an accent. So the black female was sitting in the audience, and the suspected racist white man, his daughter and his wife, two white women now, they were making comments about, does this lady need to be, picked up and deported? And she's like a candidate for the school board. So she had basically just told them, or just asked or requested of them, could they give her the same courtesy and, I guess, respect. That's the word she used, because she posted it online. And the lady, the white lady, started putting her finger in her face. And the black female says, you know, I'm not a child, so don't put your finger in my face. And she got up and walked away. And she came back and sat in another seat. And the white woman was basically saying, oh, you know, you and your people did a good job not doing something tonight. So practicing racism. And she said something about, I'm tired of all of these, you know, GD people, that profane language, GD. And she was posting about this. And the guy, I think his name's Gunnar Paulson, interesting first name, Gunnar. So he hadn't really, gave any kind of response to the black female and how she was treated, because she definitely tried to remove herself from the intense situation. And it was, once again, definitely practicing racism, but it didn't seem like no one wanted to really, I guess, intervene. So it was one of those kind of events. And as far as the question I was raised by, I think that was Ivy, I guess when it comes to black people, like I would say in terms of solving the problem or coming up with the means of solving the problem, it's definitely going to have to be to where we are going to have to interact in a more constructive manner with each other. And we have we can just start out and say, like, our own personal, I guess, flaws or deficiencies or issues that we have to work out with ourselves if we're going to inform other black people correctly and more extensively other non-whites. And I don't really like to put that, because I know Mr. Fuller and Dr. Wilson like to put that that time stamp on it, or a setting for time, like, hey, we can have this done in this amount of time, or we shouldn't make it seem like it's going to take this many years, in eternity or something like that. Not meaning or using kind of metaphor, but making it seem like it's going to take a long amount of time. And that was my answer to that, and thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. Did you hear about the Clearwater incident? We had a few folks, Mr. Steele and retired firefighter, discussed it. Did you hear about the Clearwater incident down in Florida, the shooting?
I did remember hearing about it briefly. I think it was somebody on the ground or something, and I believe someone pulled a gun out and shot someone. Was that the story? Or
yes, sir. I just
started trying to get back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just heard of it myself from retired firefighter. He mentioned it first. I just heard it this evening. Just was close to your area. Thought you might have heard a word or two about all that. Incidentally, even though this is my first time hearing about all of this, this sounds like the type of case that could become racial theater, like the last time that this happened in Florida. I would not encourage people to track the case in the same manner. It's not saying that this black male's life does not matter. It's not saying to not be informed about the case, but I think that they will frequently use incidents like this where they already know we're not going to prosecute this race soldier for this killing. They already know that this is what's going to be. And they'll drag this out for the next 12 months and have tons of programs and talk about it and show this person's baby pictures and wheel out their family or bring out family members to discuss the case in different angles. And then they'll show you the corpse and the video and all of this. And in my view, it really serves to annihilate black mental health. That was the result. That's what happened in 2013. You can go back in the archives. People called in and were crying. I remember black people that normally don't even talk about racism, were talking about how depressed and sad that they were watching all of that. I would highly discourage binge consuming details about this incident, because they will just make this racial theater. Did we miss anybody? Any folks that we've not heard from at all? Did we get everybody? grand. I'll give a look through the switchboard to make sure I did not make an error and overlook a hand. I can also answer. I think I can at least do two things. The question about that Ivy presented about are blacks going to be able to solve this problem themselves, or non-white people, is it realistic to expect assistance from non-white, non-black people? The context of white supremacy has received quite a bit of significant support from non-white, non-black people, support that, you know, I could probably itemize specifically, like very concrete things that might even be substantial enough to say I would be curious to see if the cows would still be here if I had not received a substantial amount of help. We have a substantial number of listeners who are non-white, non-black people, some people who've been listening for quite some time, even though they do not call in. That's one example. Other folks have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is V from New York. Very quickly, I have been listening to numerous Francis Cress Welsing videos over the last about 2 weeks. And I was first introduced to her actually through your show, Gus. And I didn't realize the depth of wisdom that she had until I actually purchased her book, and then a couple of years later started listening to some of her lectures. And it is absolutely fascinating and a tragedy in my, truthfully, in the way that I view how she was taken out, which may be a metaphor, but how she was relieved of her duties in the academic world, even though she continued to do the work that she was doing. And for anybody who is encountering people who are becoming less confused about racism, I mean, many of us, I think, are encountering those people and want a way of introducing some of these concepts in a less than intimidating way, I would definitely suggest videos from YouTube from Francis Cress Welsing, especially the earlier ones, when I feel there is in her clarity. I mean, her clarity never waned, but the clarity and the energy that was evident in those videos, excuse me, really is moving. So that's all I'd like to say. Everybody have a good night.
Much obliged, V. The caller at 4753, did you have commentary? 4753.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Rob, in Wisconsin.
Greetings. Very quickly, I didn't call in late. I have my hand up, but I didn't get it up right away.
My fault.
Oh, no problem. No apologies. So I'm reminded of the clip of Nellie Fuller, I think his label, How to Tell a Racist. And he says that if he could create a flag, it would be made out of transparent material with the question mark on it. And that is the way that I'm feeling right now. I'm just questioning everything. In fact, I'm really questioning what being classified as black means. My grandfather was born in 1929, and I just came across information today that his grandparents were Cherokee Indian. And with my grandfather being born in the early 1900s, leaving me with a lot of thoughts. And thank you for taking my call.
I don't know what this has to do with your, I guess, what you're pondering, what you're thinking about, but I believe you all can make sure I'm not giving out faulty information. I believe 1929, that might be the same year Dr. King and Mr. Fuller were born. I don't know. Folks can just check to make sure that that's accurate. What is the nature, I guess, of your question? Why did getting this information make you question what it means to be classified as Black? This can't be the first time that you've heard of someone being classified as Black having what they say an ancestor who is so-called Native American.
No, it's not the first time that I've heard that, but from what I've been taught, and basically from what I've been taught and what I've been told, my roots are, and my ancestors are from Africa, and I'm questioning if that's in fact true at this point.
Right on. That, I believe, is for sure a metaphor. Roots, Africa, I think that's definitely metaphor. I think this might be a good time for a reminder, since Mr. Fuller's name has been invoked so much, one of the concepts that I think is most important, which is not popular or well-received at all, that I think does get to some of what Rob in Wisconsin was discussing. There is one race, the white race. All the rest of it, nonsense that they have made up to support the system of white supremacy. I know it is very popular to think there is a Black race. I say, no. System of white supremacy, the only reason for belonging to a race is to practice racism. And there is only one group that has done so successfully. Racist man, racist woman, racist child, collectively whites. No one else has a race, belongs to a race. I think that's why we end up with so much confusion around these concepts. But I could be in error. With that, we did our 3 hours. Much obliged to all of the folks who dialed in. I feel like I should say it twice. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. When I heard that report about the Black male going to a bar, I'm not blaming him at all. Just, you know, going there. So many incidents that I've heard, Black person in a bar. I was thinking the Black females, they were in a bar and some whites accused them of being prostitutes. That was the one that got a lot of attention recently. There was the report, I think, overseas, Black student. He was in Greece, I believe. He went to a bar and he ended up being killed. That one got a lot of attention recently. We had the different incident. Black male football player, I believe, in one of the big schools, major bowl game, I think at University of Oklahoma, was on their football team, was at a bar, had some sort of kerfuffle with a white woman, suspected racist, and got in all this trouble, almost had his whole career ruined as a young person. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. If we are in a system of white supremacy, if you see Black people being shot down outside of Walmart, oh man, at a bar where race soldiers are intoxicated and maybe armed, oh man, you're asking for trouble. It's an environment with a lot of hazards. It would be best to avoid these types of places in a system of white terrorism. Thanks for everyone tuning in. The iTunes archives are up to date. Hopefully I'll be able to upload this broadcast promptly within minutes. And then all of the recent broadcasts will be available. iTunes, Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube. Thanks again to Mr. Fox. We will be back. Check Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page for the upcoming broadcasts. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. If you are going to be out and about, remain codified. Retired firefighter, great illustration right there. Now think about that situation. He gets rear-ended, as they say, by a race soldier if he's under the influence. Now you got to explain all this or try to think in a cogent manner to make a phone call to enforcement officials, see how that goes. They might have even, did they give you a breathalyzer or anything? Did they give a breathalyzer on the scene, retired firefighter? Any sort of sobriety checks if he's still with us?
No.
Okay. No sobriety checks. But just imagine, that's the sort of thing to keep in mind in a system of racism, white supremacy be codified at all times. It would be grand if we could just be frolicking and having fun. That is not the planet as it exists today. Sobriety would be best. Dr. Welsing certainly would encourage that. Let's take excellent care of our brain computers so that we can go about this business and solve this problem. Connected, the way that I typically say it, in addition to sobriety, let's buckle up each and every time we are in a vehicle. Were you buckled up in the vehicle, you and your offspring, retired firefighter?
Yes, sir. As a firefighter, as long as I was, I've learned to do that because the seatbelts do save lives.
Regular PSA, context of white supremacy. And in addition, seatbelt might help minimize contact with race soldiers. Both very constructive reasons to buckle up each and every time you are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.